United Nations is welcoming the 5 billionth person alive in the world.
The White House today denies reports the U.S. sent weapons-related equipment to Iran as late as last month. The recent scandal at the PTL ministry are taking a toll on the credibility.
Kim Baker resigned.
In a very wrong world. can't taste the meat, then what's the point?
Welcome to Afternoons with Tracy and Friends, the local talk show that stimulates your mind and keeps you thinking about things going on in your world. From local issues to topics of global importance, Tracy and Friends keeps you informed and keeps the conversation going. Call to talk to Tracy and Friends at 347-945-5229, 330-781-9600, or toll free at 1-866-530-WSOM. Listen online at tracyandfriends.com or at 600WSOM.com. And now, here's Tracy Winbush.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to Tracy and Friends here on WSOM AM 600. Hope you're having a good day today. It is 7 minutes after the hour of 12 noon here on the 18th of July. Today is Thursday. Tomorrow's Friday, and we are almost at the end of the day. And today is, I believe, third Thursday. So, Mark, third Thursday? Yeah, Mark.
Third Thursday.
So, Mark Manji's here with us, and it's always a Mark, you know, it's not that complicated. I gave you a little toy, and, you know, you are the brains in this room. Mark.
You know, talk with my wife. Look, you know, ask her about giving me a screwdriver. Look, it won't work. Oh, look at that. You know, I just.
Look at that. When you put a little gadget inside.
Your erstwhile talk show hostess gave me a stand for my pad. And you have to be a mechanical engineer to get it set up.
Mark, it only has three parts.
That's too many.
It only has two. It only has three moving parts.
Nah, I look at it and I go, It's like a Rubik's cube, you know.
It is. But it works.
It's wonderful.
It's small. It's concise. It fits in your man bag.
Yeah, it fits in my man bag.
It's out of the way.
I love my man bag. It's wonderful. I keep all sorts of stuff in there.
I think more and more men are going to start carrying man bags because, I mean, you can only carry so much in your pocket.
Well, you know, by the time you got your phone and your pads and your key to this and your key to that and your briefcase and all this stuff, to get me into the house, you know, I feel like I'm a bumbling old man. I'm dropping stuff everywhere, going in the garage, trying to get to the door to unlock the door. And none of us is 20 anymore, are we?
Speak for yourself. I just made 21. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I love coming here to be on Tracy's show because she gives me stuff. All right, she gave me the stand, and then she brought to share with me a piece of this wonderful chocolate pecan stuff. It is the best pecan roll cake kind of thing I've ever had in my life. I generally don't like them, and then I tasted it, and oh, my Lord, a little bit of heaven right here in Youngstown.
It
was
wonderful.
Called,
there's a new place, and so for you, those of you who are listening to us locally, here in the Youngstown area, and I might as well give them a free plug like we do everybody else, but there is a place called the Valley Marketplace, and they have this mall of vendors, various vendors. And it has anywhere from donuts and pastries to lemonade stands to coffee stands to fresh meat, fresh produce. They have bird cages and bird seed, and they have gifts and things in there. They have furniture, and everything is pretty much, for the most part, all Amish. And they have really outdone themselves in here when it comes to food, and they're only open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
I thought they were
open every day. I may be wrong. I have to check and see. I don't know, but I will say this: yeah, the Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I thought they were open every day. But it's amazing.
The only thing that would make it better.
What's that?
Some sweet butter.
Heat it up just a tad of that butter. Yeah, Mark, that's bad. Because yesterday, this is how it happened. Yesterday I went in there and Pastor Rusty Wills, who's a friend of mine, he asked me to meet him there. He said, I want you to see this place you're really going to like. So I go up there to see him. And while I'm in there, he said, they're trying to, and everything, they're giving you samples.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, no, this is bad. This is really, really bad. This does not fit into the diet. I'm doing healthy eating, very little. They're just absolutely wonderful.
I'm going to tell you what, Tracy. That healthy eating stuff I can take so far. I mean, that's good. I'm all for healthy eating. But at the end of the day, when you're on your deathbed ready to meet your maker, nobody ever says, gee, I wish I ate more fish.
No, but what I don't want to become ill.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that as I get older, I'm healthy, because I don't want to be diabetic. I want to be have a good, reasonable portion of great health. I don't want to have a lot of weight of inflammation where I can't walk. I don't want to have I don't want surgeries for knees and stuff. I want to be healthy and fit, and I want to look like my mom.
Your mom's a sweetheart. Love your mother.
I want to be shapely and dainty and beautiful like my mom, and my mom is healthy.
Yeah, I look like my Uncle Placido.
Placido Domingo?
No, just Placido. He would be my great uncle. Would be my grandmother's brother, who she hadn't seen since she was 14. But somebody sent her a picture back from old country years and years and years ago. When we were cleaning out her stuff after she died, we came across a picture of Uncle Placido. Scared me half to death. And then my wife says, "You look just like him," and she's right.
You look just like him. But you know what? I realize your son looks just like you.
No, he's better looking. He's thin, better looking, and
he looks just like you.
He has a chin. I've got three. He only has one.
That's because he goes to the gym every day, and his dad doesn't go.
I walk.
Okay, walking is good, but your son goes to the gym.
Yeah, I know he goes.
But
to
you
the
guys,
gym.
You guys have both that. You have that grin. He's gonna get me. Hey, listen. I have a guest coming on. His name is William Dotson, and he's written a book called "The Dictator's Learning Curve: Inside the Global Battle for Democracy." And we're going to dive into this book in about 3 or 4 minutes. So I'm glad to have him on. He does a blog, and he will give us the blog address to it, since I don't know it off the top of my head. And, Mark, I gave this to you so that you can read it really fast.
Okay.
Because, you know, you read it really fast. What else am I doing? Oh, and then after we get done talking with him for about 40 minutes, at the top of the hour, I promise you, I'm going to ask Mark what his thoughts are on what's going on in the marketplace. I see where Congress is going to take up the Voting Rights Act and try to make it to where it's equitable for all. I want to ask you about what you thought about as a lawyer from the Zimmerman trial and what you think about the media spin on all of this, because I'm quite sure Mark has a lot to say. Mark knows best.
Mark knows it all.
Oh, Mark knows it all.
That's right.
Mark knows it all. So we're going to find out just exactly what Mark knows. And what else? TSA is now they're searching cars in the parking lot.
Are they?
Yeah.
What are they going to? You mean I have to take all my contraband out of my car now?
Absolutely. TSA is searching parked cars at airports.
Where do I go with the porn?
Just make sure it's covered with caramel pecan pie.
They're watching my phone. They're watching my computer. They're watching my car. You know, they gotta be bored to death.
Wow, TSA actually put a note on this lady's car and said, "We searched your car.
Get out."
I'm waiting for it to come up, but yeah, that's what
with no probable cause, nothing. You know, the gentleman is going to be coming and talking about dictatorship. I want to hear what he has to say about this stuff.
This is going
to
be interesting.
Under the TSA regulations. That's the message this woman found in her car at the Rochester airport when she got back from a trip. She says she had no warning that someone was going to search her car after she left to catch her flight. She contacted us thinking this is something that you should be aware of, so we wanted to know who was searching her car, and is every car that parks at the airport inspected by the TSA? New at 5:30, we asked Berkeley Breen to get those answers for you tonight. Berkeley?
Leah, the woman who contacted me says she had no warning about this inspection. I found out that it happened to her because she valet parked her car. Those are the only cars getting inspected. So this begs the question, we think. If security feels it's necessary to search some cars in the name of safety, why not search all of them? Lori Iacuzzo walked to her waiting car at the airport after returning from a trip, and that's when she found it.
It was left right here.
It was a notice saying that her car was inspected after she left for her flight.
Hello?
I was furious. They never mentioned it to me when I had booked the valet, or when I picked up the car, or when I dropped it off.
Iacuzzo's car was inspected by the valet attendants on orders from the TSA. But why only valet parked cars? That's what we wanted to ask the TSA director about. We reached him by phone.
Are the cars in the short-term lots and the long-term lots getting searched as well?
No.
So what's the difference?
Those vehicles are in the garage, short-term, long-term parking. Even if they carried pretty large amounts of explosive, would not cause damage to the front of the airport, but there's the use of valet, the car could be there for a half hour or an hour, so that, you know, there is a vulnerability.
We went to the valet parking today. One of the attendants showed us the notice that they have to put in the cars.
You're required. They tell you you have to search the car.
I have to do it.
And look at what we noticed on the kiosk window, a large sign that alerts customers that their vehicle will be inspected. We showed this to Lori Iacuzza.
I want to show you a picture I took at the airport today.
Okay.
This is the valet kiosk.
Hey, Bill,
you remember
right
seeing
you.
That sign?
No, it wasn't out there. But I think the public should be aware of the fact that if their car is going to be searched, they should be informed of it.
Lori said she doesn't mind the security measure at all. In fact, she makes it feel a little bit more secure. She just wants to be told that if her car is getting searched. I asked the owner of the company that runs the valet parking, when did they put that sign up? He wouldn't answer that question. The TSA says this is part of its overall security plan and that it's a proactive move to keep you and your family safe at the airport.
Geez,
the attendants told me they've only been doing this for about a month. Leo?
Now, I want to talk about that, just as a matter of course. There was a story on the news 2 days ago about your comings and goings being tracked through cars, through license plate cameras, and how they're maintaining, they're maintaining records of where you've been, where you're going, and everything right now. And the expert on television said no one has an expectation of privacy when they're driving on a road because license plates are out and they're just license plates. He said, but if they want to go through your car, they got to get a warrant. What is this? What are we doing to ourselves? This is the first I've heard of it. I'm floored. Absolutely floored. We're in trouble. We're in trouble.
How you doing, Will?
Good, good. Hi. Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you. What do you think about all this going on? Because the name of your book is called The Dictator's Learning Curve. And before we get into the meat of the book, Dictator's Learning Curve, what do you think about where we're going, what we're doing?
What we're doing in terms of?
Of just America. Just where we are, foreign policy, national security, TSA. What do you think about all this?
In terms of foreign policy, there's a lot there. I mean, you know, the president's foreign policy is in large measure has been not really entirely his own. It's been something that has been shaped by the policies that he inherited. So, you know, for example, you take what's going on in the Middle East today and the sort of widening civil war in Syria, the unrest in Egypt, right then and there, there's just certain options that this administration can't really explore because everyone knows that American tolerance for greater engagement in a region of the world like that is virtually nil because to the degree there was ever tolerance for something like that, it was exhausted by the previous 10 years. And so what you're left with is, you know, a foreign policy that is in many ways shaped by or has options on the table that really aren't there because it's a part of a continuum, part of a hangover, a legacy of previous foreign policies, and in particular that of those 8 years under the Bush administration. So, that's the broad sort of, you know, backdrop to what the president's doing now. And so then you look at that and say, well, are you making the best of those possibilities? And I think in large measure he is.
So the foreign policy that we have, because right now there is major unrest in the
right.
Middle East. We don't have and some of the things that he said during his campaign that he was going to change and he was going to do, it doesn't look like he's been able to do that. If anything, he's just continued the same foreign policy of the Bush administration.
I don't know. I mean, I think in the case of a place like, take Egypt, for example, what could any White House, what could any president do to change the events occurring in Egypt? I mean, I think we have contacts with the Egyptian military. We try to shape their decision making. We give our advice. we put pressure on them in terms of what we'd like them to do. But at the end of the day, no White House can dictate what someone in another country is going to do in a struggle such as that. So I think we often sort of overestimate America's ability to be involved in such political situations like that. And when we do get involved, you know, for good reason, and many times Americans say, well, why are we there? Why are we involved? So you can't really have it both ways, and both at the one hand criticize being involved and then say, well, why aren't you doing more to prevent people from going out in the streets? I mean, his responsibility is running the domestic policy of the United States and our foreign policy and to maximize those objectives where possible. But, we are giving the Egyptian military, the Egyptian regime, $1.5 billion a year. We've been doing that since the late 1970s. That is about as much influence as you can have.
Do you believe, Bill, that I can understand what you're saying in terms of doing foreign policy day to day? Do you think that there is a flaw, though, in the basic foundation of American foreign policy in the Mideast? And I'm thinking more in terms of, you know, you can't. My rule in life is you can't argue logically with illogical people. Is there a fundamental issue between our view of life and their view of life that makes any serious foreign policy workable?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I think the people that we encounter and the regimes and governments we encounter are actually highly rational. And I think that's across the board. We may disagree with their interests, and our interests may be not aligned, but I actually think when you generally look at the foreign policies that our foreign policy is brushing up against, people are pursuing their goals fairly rationally. The question is what one is willing to do to try and change that, you know, to try and change their interests, or to what degree do we have influence that can set other countries in a different direction. So, I mean, if you take the Middle East in general, it's just broad brush and you look at it. Well, I mean, to some degree, what we have seen in the last several years is the bill coming due on decades of policy. Now, that's not to say that those decades of policy were wrong, but what have, you know, Condoleezza Rice actually was, I think, you know, very correct when she said in a speech near the end of her time as Secretary of State that for too long we prized stability over all else. And if you were, you know, and I was in Egypt in, you know, during the Bush administration years, and if you were there then, I mean, there was no question that the policy that was in place, our so-called alliance with Mubarak, was an anachronistic policy. I mean, it had sort of outlived in many ways its usefulness. But the thing was, is it's very difficult to move that onto other ground. I mean, you know, it's a very delicate, volatile situation. And the Bush administration was telling Mubarak, had been telling him for years, look, you're running out of time. Look. The ground is shifting under your feet. You want to be on the right side of this, and he didn't listen to them. And he may have had good reason not to, because he could have known, and he would have been correct that once those forces were unleashed, that his days were numbered. And indeed, it did happen. It did happen because the Egyptian people made it happen. But the U.S. had for, and you could say, you know what? If I could do it over again, I'd do it the same way. Having decades of stability ain't bad, but it is the case that a lot of the regimes that we are allied with in the region were highly oppressive, authoritarian dictatorships, and their repression of their own people was something that was always going to have an expiration date. Now people are now engaged with their politics, are taking control of their politics, and in some instances we're going to like it, and in some instances we're not.
I think the fundamentalist Muslims over there provide a backdrop that actually promotes dictatorships. The only way you can combat that is through a dictatorship. I don't, because it's so vehement and so strong. Democracy I as our perception of democracy, I can't think of one Middle East country outside of Turkey that maintains any kind of democracy at all. It just doesn't work there. You've got two groups of people, maybe three factions, the Sunnis, you've got the Shiites, and then you have the people who are secular fighting with each other. There's no resolution. How could you develop a policy in that mess?
Well, I mean, you have to deal with then right now, and here's the situation. I mean, the reality in Egypt right now is that the people that we would like to believe we characterize as being sort of Western secular liberals, those people have allied themselves with a military that has just brought about a military coup, that has acted undemocratically. And the people that concern you in the Muslim Brotherhood, these people are protesting and putting themselves at risk in order to restore the democratic legitimacy of their government. They were told, look, participate in elections. They did. They participated in elections. The elections were clean. People came out and voted. They voted. They won. They have observed the protocols.
Let me backtrack a little bit on that, Mr. Dobson, with what you're saying. You've got, and I'm going to go back and look at Nazi Germany. Hitler was elected. Now, you start with that premise, and you look at what the Germans do to suppress the Nazi Party in Germany, and that is an absolutely undemocratic thing that they're doing, and I agree with it 100%. You can't let that strain get in the political process because democracy can't handle it.
Well, no, that's not true. Democracy can't handle it. What we see across the region is Islamist parties that, you know, what happens is this, is you have governments that are highly repressive. If they begin to open up, because of that, those repressive years, what happens when people live in just dire poverty, and let me get very specific in the case of Egypt. So in the early 1990s, there was a massive earthquake in Egypt. Egypt doesn't really have earthquakes, but they had one. And when this earthquake hit, what happened? The government did nothing. People were without shelter. People were starving. People were injured. They did nothing. The Muslim Brotherhood, you could say acting opportunistically, you could say acting charitably, whichever, stepped in very quickly. And they were the ones that provided shelter, aid, doctors to everyday citizens, whether they were, no matter who, of what religious stripe, didn't matter. Now, what you have, and that's just a microcosm of what happened, essentially you had a government that failed people. And so in dire circumstances like that, just like in any place, people, what do people do? They turn to faith. And so you've seen their numbers grow over the years. The reason the Islamists are ever popular in these countries is because it's a byproduct of the dictatorships that they're living under. People turn to them because it's rational, because they're not, no one else is helping them. And so you see these numbers rise. So then what happens? What happens is if you begin to have a little political pluralism in those first elections, Islamist parties often do well. Why do they do well? They do well because there's a lot for them to campaign against. They can say, you know what, we're against corruption. This government is corrupt. They always are in the case of these dictatorships. And that message carries the day. But then what happens? They come in, they do well in the polls, but they generally don't do very well in government. They don't perform, because it's one thing to say that Islam is the solution. It's another thing to get the garbage picked up on time on Tuesdays. And it's difficult for anyone new to government to sort of, you know, bring that competency right away. And as a result, and this is, you know, I'm just getting back to your point of it not being compatible with the democratic system, is that what ends up happening then is in the subsequent polls, they don't do as well. And so what they end up being generally is a plurality. So you end up with parliaments where you have like, a 20 to 30% sort of Islamist party. But then that's it. They don't really return to power because they're that's as they should be, because in a democracy they are representing what is an interest, but generally not an overwhelming interest. So it's quite compatible with democracy.
But this is the issue. This is my issue with this. America goes around the world in the name of democracy, not realizing that not everyone is going to be like America, and it's not going to happen. We should have a respect for other nations. But they're not going to be able to achieve what we have here because most of them don't want it. They don't, you know, Egypt does not want to become like us. And so when they had their election, they got who they elected, and it may have been a somewhat quasi-fair election, but it was really still a selection.
It was a fair election. I mean, it was actually, you know, that was actually one of the things that's most impressive about Egypt in this period of time when you know, I don't really think anyone's hope should have ever been that high for a lot of reasons. And, you know, it was always going to be a long shot. But what was actually quite amazing was how clean those elections were. And you really did, you know, you really did have a number of candidates come forward. They represented all different sort of parts of the spectrum. It was narrowed down into a runoff, and then you had a really narrow win where Morsi won barely. Yeah.
What happened? Because if I'm not mistaken, they said, "Oh, wrong one." I mean, I think America would like to go back and do that now. Oh, wrong one. You can't. There. How do you do a do-over in the middle and call it democracy if you vote for the person that's in there? That wasn't even a recall when they put him out.
No, not when they put him out. That was a coup.
Right.
I mean, let me help you look at that. I mean, yeah.
When you're looking over here, what they did with the coup in Egypt, this guy comes mm-hmm. in there. He does nothing for a year for these folks economically. He tries to neuter the court. He tries to revise the Constitution, and he's mm-hmm. building a dictatorship. Now, you've got two choices. He becomes the next dictator, and they're really, really bad people, or you get rid of them.
Yeah.
They got rid of them.
Let's go back. I mean, if you want to look at what, you know, you could argue this, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this, is that, so you have Mubarak in power. What was the conversation that was going on in Egypt, you know, for the previous 10 years? It was, you know, when Mubarak is gone, who's going to take over? Is it going to be his son, or is it going to be another general? If there was a, you know, and the reason for that is that the military has always been the backbone of this regime. If you were going to try to label what Mubarak's regime was for those 30 years, or even go back before that to Sadat, all modern Egyptian presidents have been generals. And the military is the only institution in Egypt that really functions. You know, I was there in 2006, and they were about to host the Africa Cup. And so all of Africa was going to send its soccer teams to Egypt to compete in the, you know, what is a really enormous event for them. And it was a couple months before the games were supposed to be held, and the government had contracted with builders to refurbish or build new stadiums. Nothing had been done. So what did they do? They did what they always did, which is they called the military and said, "Hey, guys, could you build us some stadiums?" And the military did it. If you go to Egypt today and you get a tourist package to go down the Nile, the tourist company that you're going to book it with almost certainly is owned by the military. They bottle the water, they pave the roads, they bake the bread, they do everything. And that's because the military in Egypt is primarily interested not in defending its borders, not thinking about Israel, not thinking about other states on its border. It's mainly interested in business. It is a business enterprise. And that was the deal that was struck between Mubarak and the generals. He said, "Look, I'll let you guys get rich. You'll get your taste. You'll get your slice. And in return, I continue to rule, and you back me." So they do that. And that bargain remains in place. Yeah?
But is that a good thing when it comes to America? Hold on, South Carolina. Is that a good thing when it comes to American foreign policy?
Well, it was a very good thing. I mean, you could say it was a very good thing, because what did we want? We wanted a policy that was going to help Israel. And so Camp David Accords, which we basically signed with the military, says, look, you ensure the peace with Israel, and in return, we'll support you. We get stability. That's what I'm saying before. That was the price. That was the sort of devil's agreement we entered in. And it was provided as someone who we didn't have to worry about anymore. We could say, you know what, at least on this one very important flank, at least along the Sinai, we're not worried about stability there. We know they're not the nicest guys in the world, but they will be there.
We are still worried about stability there. It is still not stable.
Well, you are now. We are now. But that's because that's the bill coming due. I'm sorry?
South Carolina. Go ahead. Your mic is on, South Carolina.
Here's the problem you run into, though. Isn't there a going against written policy with the military doing what it did? Technically, this is a coup they pulled.
Right, you're absolutely right. There's no question about it. If you look at what happened, there's no, you know, if it looks like a coup, if it walks like a coup, it's a coup. There's no question about it. And it's also very clear that the legislation that's in place says if there's a coup, then we're not supposed to support them any longer. So there really actually shouldn't be any debate about that. However, you know, some people would say, you know, this was the danger of when Congress gets involved with foreign policy making, because this wasn't what this was intended to handle. This was Patrick Leahy's legislation. It was intended to prevent situations like what happened in Indonesia. It wasn't intended to affect what is an erstwhile ally like Egypt. But you're right. I mean, if you're going to go by the letter of the law, just clear black and white, that's what should be happening. But most people don't want that to happen, including people in Congress, because they understand that money is the only thing that buys us any influence with the generals at all now, and we need that influence now more than ever.
But this is not the Congress didn't step in. This was President Obama, if I'm not mistaken.
This was congressional legislation. This is Congress trying to hem in presidential decision making on foreign policy, and you can say, look, we want them to do that. Perhaps they're supposed to get authorization for war before a president commits troops. No president does that, but you know, in the battle between Congress and the executive over foreign policy, we know the executive won that a long time ago, and so Congress falls sort of trails behind foreign policy making. When we elect a president, you know, there are so many ways in which a president is sort of hamstrung by what he wants to do, but foreign policy is not one of them. This is an instance where Congress was trying to put some sort of limits on what, you know, a president could do with his foreign policy, but it's not going to even be observed in this instance.
Your book, tell us what it's about.
Yes. Sure. My book is called The Dictator's Learning Curve. And so what it's looking at is the struggle between these regimes and the people who challenge them around the world. And so what I did for about 2 years is I traveled to a number of different authoritarian or dictatorial regimes, namely Russia, China, Egypt, Venezuela, Malaysia. And in each place I would go, I would meet with two groups of people. I would meet with the people that serve the regime, and I would meet with the people who are trying to upend, to turn out the regime. And what you find is it's a dynamic struggle between both sides, where what we often don't give these regimes credit for is how sophisticated they really are. We often have in our mind an image of sort of these thuggish regimes. In fact, they're very nimble, very sophisticated, which is why they've been able to persevere in what is a very difficult age for dictatorships to live in. So part of the premise of the book is we need to understand how these regimes actually function. We need to understand that sophistication so that we can put an end to it.
And do you really think that can happen?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I'm very optimistic about the way that we see events happening worldwide right now in terms of the battle between democracy and dictatorship. I'm very optimistic, and the reason I am is because the people in these countries themselves are taking the risks and thinking very creatively and intelligently about how to challenge their governments. You know, and at the end of the day, that's how this, and I think I agree entirely with you that at the end of the day, that's something that they really need to do. This is not something that the United States does particularly well. We can help them on the margins. We should give them rhetorical and diplomatic support wherever possible. But at the end of the day, the only changes that happen in these countries that are really meaningful and lasting are indigenous changes. And so that means having a population there that has the courage, intelligence, and resilience to really challenge these regimes. And we see that happening again and again. You can see it in Venezuela. You can see it in Russia. You can see it in Egypt.
But you never see it actually manifest and become that which they choose for it to become. It just doesn't happen.
Well, what, South Korea? No, the last 40 years has been a story about the expansion of democracy. I mean, what, you know, in 1974, there were about 43 democracies in the world. By 1989, that number jumped up to 76. By 2005, the number was over 120. And right now, what we see is a period where those dictatorships that are remaining are being seriously, seriously tested. I mean, this is a period of incredible struggle. But, you know, we saw nonviolent revolutions topple dictatorships in South Korea. That's why they're in, which, you know, made them from being an authoritarian ally of ours to a democratic ally. The Philippines, Serbia, all across Eastern Europe, so many instances of this. And so now we're seeing this happen in places like Venezuela, Russia, Egypt, and elsewhere.
Well, how do you explain the regression in the United States then?
How do I explain the, I'm sorry?
The regression.
The regression.
As the rest of the world moves towards democracy, we look like we're, under this administration, seem to be moving towards
a dictatorship.
Well, some people say totalitarianism and dictatorship.
Well, I think you know. Let me put it this way: if you've lived in a totalitarian country, you know the difference between a totalitarian system and what we have in the United States.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm saying we're trying towards that.
What are you saying, Mark? What do you think about our handling of Iran and turning our backs on what was the Greener Student Movement going through there a year or two ago? Why did we do that?
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of Iranians about that, and it's a really difficult situation for an administration to find themselves in because, on the one hand, you want to provide rhetorical support, but there's really only so much you can do, and before you risk undermining the people who are challenging the government itself. Let me give you an example, one that I like that sort of sums it up. You know, in the case of Serbia, say, go back to 2000, you had, you know, Milosevic in power, you know, the most brutal dictator in Europe at that time. And, you know, there was a student movement that was beginning to challenge Milosevic and ultimately succeeds in ousting him in 2000. But it's before that happened, and they were really catching on and doing really well. And people in the United States were following it and debating what we should do to intervene or whatnot. And this group, this student movement, was called ATPOR. And Madeleine Albright, who was then the Secretary of State, was a big supporter of ATPOR. And it got to the students. They heard through channels that Madeleine Albright kept a sticker, one of the group's stickers that said ATPOR, which meant resistance in Serbian, that she kept that on her desk at the State Department. And they said, you know what? The students' message back was, you know what? That's great. We're glad to hear that you're fans. Please keep it to yourself. The reason was that the Milosevic regime was always trying to tie these people who were challenging Milosevic to being pawns or proxies of the United States, because they understood that if they could do that, if they could make that linkage, then Serbians, everyday Serbians, would say, wait a minute, we don't want these people who we've been told are agents of the CIA or the American government to be taking over our government. Maybe we should be good nationalists and support Milosevic. So what it does is it undermines their credibility with the people they need to persuade. A way to think about it is this: in a place like Iran, you've got a percentage of the country, let's say 10%, that is hardcore supporters of the government. They're in the government, they work for the government, or their livelihoods depend on it. And let's say you have a 10% that is completely and utterly opposed and wants a democratic Iran. The battle in all of these countries every time is between these two poles to win over a majority of Iranians who aren't really political, who are everyday Iranians. And so you want to, on the one hand, be supportive of them rhetorically, but you want to keep it to such a level that they don't undermine the people who are really your best allies on the ground, the people you want to have win.
Tell me if I'm wrong in what I'm going to say here. It seems to me that if you look at the Mideast generally, there's two sources of power that seem to emanate in different directions that are the root cause of all of our problems over there.
Mm-hmm.
One would be Saudi Arabia, and the other would be Iran. You look at the problems with the Muslim Brotherhood. That seems to be Iranian-based. You look at the problems in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and in Pakistan. It seems to me that is Saudi Arabian-based. Why do we do business with Saudi Arabia the way we do outside of oil? Why do we allow the situation to continue to exist?
Because there's no outside of oil. I mean,
We have sent our forces in there a lot the last 15 years. We fought the Iraq War twice. We're going to get beat out of Afghanistan. And rather than building our military strength over there to protect our interests against who are very bad people by every stretch of the imagination, we turn tail and run. What are we doing? How many times do we have to fight that war over there?
I agree with you. I agree with, in the case of Saudi Arabia, I agree. I mean, but I don't, you know, you said outside of our dealings with them outside of oil. Well, that's what dictates everything. I mean, there is no outside of oil. And so it's because of that, it's because of our need for their oil that they get a free pass on so much. It's the same in the case of Bahrain. You know, there was an Arab Spring movement in Bahrain, and this is, you have a minority that's oppressively ruling a majority of a different faith, and we say nothing about Bahrain, or very, very little at least. We say nothing about Saudi Arabia. We say very little about Bahrain because we have a fleet there, and so there's a strategic interest. If you want to find moral consistency in the world, foreign policy is just not a good place to look for it.
I'm not looking for moral consistency, Bill. I'm looking for practical consistency. We've gone into Iraq twice, and we're leaving there twice.
Oil's pretty practical. If you care about practical necessity, you care about oil. I mean, I agree with you.
Take the oil. We freed those people. They owe us. We spent our money. We shed our blood, and we walk in there, and they pull us out twice. Now, how stupid is that? Iran's not going away, and I'm getting tired of hearing that, you know, it's going to collapse, blah, 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 blah. It is not. We're going to have to fight those people sooner or later. We've already fought for that territory twice. We're going to pull out of Afghanistan. Iran would be surrounded, for God's sakes. Keep a strong base, a lot of troops in Iraq, keep a strong base, a lot of troops in Afghanistan, point the guns at Iran, and then tell them do whatever they want to do.
It's hard to keep a lot of troops. It's a little hard to keep a lot of troops in a country that doesn't want to have your troops there. I mean, in the case of Iraq,
all the time.
I mean, again, in the case of Iraq, the Iraqis do not want there to be a lot of troops there, and so there will not be a lot of troops there. I mean, this is as simple as that.
That matters to people like yourself. But back in the day, it didn't matter. You went in there and you took it over. Screw them.
Well, we did try to do that. We did do that. I mean, you don't have to go that far back. You don't have to go that far back in the day to find an instance of that happening. That was the Iraq War. That's what we did.
I'm still confused by that. We went over there, we blew up the place, and now we have to fix it, and we spent all our money, we shed our blood, and then we come back home, and we still haven't resolved the issue, and it is what it is, and we still go back, and we call it great foreign policy. I'm concerned.
We're not going back. We're not going back. No. I mean, everything you said was right. We went over there, we blew it up, and Colin Powell, you break it, you own it. We had to fix it. The whole point, the reason the Bush administration ultimately gave us, after it went through a number of reasons as to why we had to fight that war, ultimately they settled on, we were trying to make it a democracy, which wasn't the original reason, of course, but we never found those weapons. So, as a result, we then did our best to try to fix it, but, you know, Americans' patience for being involved in other people's affairs only takes you so far, and so we had to get out. And that's why the Bush administration, not the Obama administration, but the Bush administration, signed the status of force agreements, which allowed us to pull out. The pullout began even before Obama, and now we're seeing it through because we want to get out. But, you know, if you're concerned about Iran's being diminished, that's actually happening. I mean, you know, you can be very upset, and I hope everyone would be upset about what we're seeing in Syria. But from the cold logic of realpolitik foreign policy, it's very much what the United States would want to see happen, because what's happening is Iran is having to spend its treasure and its own blood to try and fight that war. That's what's happening. Hezbollah is there being killed and fighting against other Arabs. We have Arabs killing Arabs in Syria. So from a Kissingerian point of view, this is exactly as you'd have it. Now the Americans don't have to do this. This is happening through the regional chaos that is the Middle East.
Hey, well, listen, I got to go. I got to go to the break. I want to thank you, Bill. I want to thank you, Will, for coming on, and I enjoy the book is called The Dictator's Learning Curve Inside the Global Battle for Democracy.
I like him.
And you have to come back and hang out with us again. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, guys.
And I'm going to take a break. I'll be back. And when we come back, it's open mic. Me and Mark are going to sit here, and we're talking about TSA. I've got to talk about the new Black Panther Party and the bond. And then I've got to talk about George Zimmerman filing a suit against Trayvon Martin's family. We'll be right back.
Boardman Frame House Gallery, a professional frame shop and art gallery at the Mark Shopping Center in Poland at Routes 224 and 680. We specialize in original, limited, and antique lithographs of both renowned nationally published artists and local artists. We have over 30 years of award-winning custom design and archival framing. We give your artwork a unique presentation that enhances its value for life. Let your home or office express something individual and unique with a fine art limited edition print signed by the artist and numbered. You'll find many unique and affordable fine art editions. Visit us in the Mark Shopping Center. Find the Greenwich Workshop Catalog. And for any print or canvas you order, you get 50% off the frame for that fine art edition. Find us on Facebook or call us at 330-758-5795. That's 330-758-5795.
Hi, this is Bill Johnson. I'm your congressman. You know, I've spent so much time visiting and talking with folks across eastern and southeastern Ohio. We've talked about keeping America energy independent and forcing the federal government to live by a responsible budget. We've talked about helping our veterans, reining in the IRS, and even my new project that encourages fatherhood. These discussions help me each time I travel to Washington to represent you in Congress. Although I go there to cast my votes, my family and I live right here in Ohio, and I can do my job even better when I hear from you. That's why I'll be at the Carroll County Fair to hear your thoughts on issues important to you.
I'm glad Bill Johnson is coming to the fair. He's not like the politicians in Washington. He's one of us.
My family enjoys the county fair, and we're looking forward to talking with Bill Johnson.
Join Bill Johnson at the Carroll County Fair. For a full list of fairs that Bill Johnson will attend, or to connect with Bill, visit BillJohnsonLeads.com. Paid for by Johnson for Congress.
We're back with Tracy and Friends on News Talk 600 WSOM. 347-945-5229 or toll-free 1-800-530-WSOM. Online at TracyAndFriends.com or 600WSOM.com. Now, here's Tracy.
Hey, we're back, and it's a short break because I got to go to the top of the hour break in about 7 minutes. I got Mark Manji with me today, and we are talking politics. I started with foreign policy because I knew that that would not create a firestorm before I got into other issues. And so I'm going to pick with Mark for a few minutes. South Carolina, your mic is on. We're going to pick with Mark for a little bit, talk about the sun shining, the warm heat in Mahoning Valley, the Roseville,
so
Mount Carmel fair this
so
afternoon.
Hot.
And then when we come back at 1 o'clock, we're going to get hot in here. Hope you get the air conditioner's working.
That's nice. We're having trouble with mine at home. It's hot.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's ours is like 20-some years old. I think it's on its last leg. We're going to try to get through this,
ooh,
and then we're going to dump it. It's bad.
Well, I went into a lady's house on yesterday evening, and her home, her air conditioner, she's getting some remodeling done, so they had to take the air conditioning unit out.
Yeah.
Her house was it was like a furnace, and then she had the fan going, and the fan was blowing hot air. Was like, I said, well, let's just sit outside because I'm not staying in here with y'all. It was unbelievable.
Of course, but between hot and cold, I'll take hot because when it's hot, you can always sit down and rest. When it's cold, you got to go to where it's warm. And
Goodness gracious.
What's the temperature down there right now?
Right now it's 95 degrees.
Okay, that's about where we're
at. The heat index is supposed to go up to about 102.
I don't know how you folks down in the South live that way. It's just awfully, awfully hot.
We developed darker skin to handle it.
You know, you get the hurricanes coming up the coast and all that heat in the summer.
But I tell you what, though, guys, we've gotten an enormous amount of rain here.
Yeah.
Over the past, couple months. Our drought is over with, I can tell you that.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. We've had a lot of rain up here, too. We planted some trees, and it was great because the trees are really growing. They like the rain. They kind of like the sun and the heat right now. But we're going to get a break this Saturday. It's supposed to get kind of nasty, and the humidity of the front's going to come through, and all this is going to go away. So I'm looking forward to that. Tracy.
Does it mean it's going to snow?
No.
We
have
some wild winters
crazy
up here.
Pardon me?
Did the chill just run up your back when I said snow?
We're going to have a nice, calm winter.
You think so?
Don't start. No, absolutely. We have to because I'm calling for it. Hold on. Local call, your mic is on.
Hello?
Hello?
I wanted to say about Afghanistan. Now, the Russians tried for 10 years, didn't they, to try to help over there, and they didn't get anywhere.
Yes, they did. From my understanding, they tell me when you go to war over in the desert like that, our troops are not prepared for the desert like that. They said that we're just not. Those people are so patient, and they're so tunnel driven that we're just not prepared for it.
Right, and I can remember. I don't know how many years ago this was. Cher, you know, the popular singer Cher, I think she offered a ton of money to help build better Humvees or, you know, those things they ran around in. So they were getting hurt so bad with another thing I wanted to mention, I think it's the whole thing behind it is oil, too. If you think of our oil prices and we can't get that Keystone Pipeline and stuff, oil is the key here.
The question is, we got oil, so why don't we drill for it?
That's it. I mean, I don't know. They seem to stir up all this mess over there. And
the thing that gets me is they say that it's all about oil. Yeah, it is all about oil. The problem is when somebody says that, they say it like in a negative way. I say it's about oil. Let's admit it's about oil. Let's go get the oil and fooey on these people. You just reached the end.
Right.
Or Mark, drill our own oil.
I love the show.
We love you, too. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. We love you. We appreciate you listening in and calling in. Please, anytime, just call in and hang out with us.
And with Zimmerman, I want to hear what you have to say. Something
I found out. I found it was a hoax. Somebody just texted me, and it was a hoax, and I've been looking it up online.
What are we looking?
They say God works in mysterious ways. Maybe this is to bring us all together more or stop these shenanigans, but we're not going to change men's hearts.
No, but God.
Change, you know.
But it's going to change.
Nothing's new under the sun. I forget where it's at in the Bible. Nothing new under the sun. You know.
Ecclesiastes.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Struggle on and do our best until he comes back, I guess.
But I read an article and said that Zimmerman filed a charge against the Martin family, but it is untrue. It is a hoax. How did they do that?
You were talking about that. I couldn't figure out what you were talking about. I hadn't heard that.
I'm reading it right here. But when I do come back, I've really got to talk about the Black Panther Party and the $10,000 bounty. I'll be right back.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
You know what? There's this place down the street that has caramel pecans. And Mark won't act right.
I'm going to tell you what. The world can be going to hell and back in a handbasket. But if it's going with this pecan stuff that Tracy brought back here, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to care too much.
No. I read it. Yes, ma'am.
I was tuning in just when you were saying about that lady getting her car searched. Where was that? What state?
Rochester, wasn't it?
I think so.
New York, I believe.
Yeah.
That was legitimate.
Do that.
Yeah, pick up on Drudge Report. If you go to Drudge Report, you can they're reporting on that big article on there.
Do you check Alex Jones out too?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Hey, listen,
thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening in. I've got to go take a break. You're listening to Tracy and Friends here on WSOM AM 600. While we're gone, we're going to go find something to drink behind all this. And we'll be right back. Again, the number is 347-945-5229. We're looking forward to having you on with us today. Want to hear from you today, and please give us a call. And Mark, when you get, why don't we come back? You got to quit cutting that thing because it's bad.
I'll tell you, I've got half of it. You had one piece. I had three pieces.
That's bad. I'm going to tell Ginger on you. We'll be right back.
iHeartRadio plays your favorite station and over 1,500 more live local stations through your mobile device. So when you leave town, you can still hear the sounds and programming you love and discover more like music, sports, news. There's lots there, and iHeartRadio is always free. Just download the app for Android, iPhone, iPad, Windows Phone, and more. Find out what over 20 million registered users already know at iHeartRadio.com.
WSOM, Salem, Youngstown, Warren, the home for afternoons with Tracy and friends. News Talk 600 WSOM.
Yeah, pretty intense, but we don't see any difficulties with the engine at this point.
The plane did manage to return safely to Reagan National Airport. President Obama says his health care law is working.
And in states that are working hard to make sure that this law delivers for their people, what we're seeing is that consumers are getting a hint of how much money they're potentially going to save because of this law.
The president defending his plan in a White House speech a day after the Republican-controlled House voted to delay two key components. The Dow back in record territory, up 84 points at 15,554. This is ABC News.
Hi, I'm Diane Caridou. I'm a senior Medicare Patrol volunteer. Our program, sponsored by Medicare and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, helps seniors learn to protect themselves from Medicare frauds and scams. For instance, if you're a Medicare beneficiary and you're approached with an offer of free medical equipment or services, watch out. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Call 1-800-MEDICARE to report it. And go to stopmedicarefraud.gov to find lots of useful tips and important information about new fraud-fighting tools that Medicare now has, thanks to the health care law. New resources to help law enforcement crack down on criminals and return taxpayer dollars to the Medicare trust funds. And how you can get involved in the fight against fraud. Go to stopmedicarefraud.gov and help make Medicare stronger for all of us. A message from Medicare and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
It's still summer, but retailers are already looking ahead. Well, maybe not that far ahead, to back-to-school shopping. New study says we may not be spending as much this year on supplies as we did last. Here's ABC's Richard Davies.
From clothes to computers, binders to backpacks, shoppers plan to spend nearly 8% less this year, according to the National Retail Federation. 8 in 10 school shoppers say economic conditions will change their spending in some way. The survey suggests many parents will attempt to save by going to stores earlier for sales, shopping online, and by having children reuse items bought in last year's booming back-to-school season. Richard Davies, ABC News.
Three young people who have been living in the U.S. illegally are planning to test the country's immigration laws. They're traveling to Mexico and then will try to come back into the U.S. The members of the National Immigrant Youth Alliance want to draw attention to the law and to a huge jump in deportations carried out under the Obama administration. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Do you have unfiled tax returns or owe the IRS or state more than $10,000? If you don't take action now, your tax problem is only going to get worse. Seizure of property, bank levies, wage garnishments, and potential criminal prosecution. Call the experts at U.S. Tax Shield for help at 1-800-334-5070. Our tax advisors will review your case for free, inform you of your rights, and give you a guaranteed quote. And we have an A-plus rating with the BBB. So get protected. Call U.S. Tax Shield now at 1-800-334-5070.
Who are we at Buckeye Firearms? We are active in our churches, schools, and communities. We raise our kids to know the words to the national anthem. We vote and we pay taxes. We are former and current members of the military and law enforcement. We are avid hunters. We shoot competitively. You will find NRA lifetime membership cards in our wallet. Who are we at Buckeye Firearms? We are your friends, neighbors, and we support your Second Amendment rights. Visit us in Rogers, Austintown, and Streetsboro and experience the Buckeye Advantage.
I'm Harper.
Robert Keegan with your headline news. A carport collapses on a grandmother and two boys in Boardman. They were injured, but they're expected to be okay. Now police are trying to figure out who was driving the car that caused the port to come down. It happened on Lehman's Drive. Witnesses say the Toyota hit the poles holding it up, and that's when it came crashing down, trapping the woman and two boys under the age of five. Neighbors, police, and others helped lift the carport to get all three out. Mahoning County Sheriff Sergeant James Tuville has agreed to a three-day unpaid suspension for his role in the county auditor's OVI case. Auditor Michael Scortino was pulled over for suspicion of OVI, and Tuville arrested him, but then allowed another sergeant to step in and unarrest him. A Warren man will spend 14 years behind bars after he shot at a home and the bullet hit a woman in the head while she was sleeping. It happened in August of last year. The woman hit in the head didn't die. She's at home, and her husband says it'll take years for her to recover. For WSOM News, I'm Harper Keegan.
This is Becky Wall from Daring Compressor. Natural gas is changing the job market, and we are truly knocking the rust off this rust belt.
Hi, this is Chris Broadwater, HR manager with Mack Trailer in Salem, Ohio. Our business here at Mack Trailer is continuing to grow, and the success of Mack Trailer can be attributed to a quality product built by quality people. Are you that next Mack Trailer employee to join our experienced workforce of over 900 employees company-wide? We are looking for you. Mack Trailer in Salem is now hiring for all three shifts at our manufacturing facility at 1453 Allen Road in the Salem Industrial Park, Salem, Ohio. Please email us at www.mactrailer.com, that's MACtrailer.com, or stop at our facility to fill out an application, or email your application to kbroadwater@mactrailer.com. Mack Trailer is an equal opportunity employer.
Steering compressor.
Welcome to Afternoons with Tracy and Friends, the local talk show that stimulates your mind and keeps you thinking about things going on in your world. From local issues to topics of global importance, Tracy and Friends keeps you informed and keeps the conversation going. Call to talk to Tracy and Friends at 347-945-5229, 330-781-9600, or toll free at 1-866-530-WSOM. Listen online at tracyandfriends.com or at 600WSOM.com. And now, here's Tracy Winbush.
Well, we're back, and you're listening to Tracy and Friends here on WSOM AM 600. I'm trying to find the clip, and I can't find it. So I've got to browse through here for real quickly. I want to play this because I have not listened to it in its entirety. But it has to do with a $10,000 bounty that they have put on George Zimmerman's head. And so I want to hear what.
Who would do this?
Somebody. I just don't. We have allowed ignorance to prevail. We truly have. And when you breed ignorance and you don't teach people the process, when you talk about the Zimmerman case, this case actually, it really, the prosecution didn't do what they should have. It was they didn't even investigate this in the beginning of the case as a homicide or as it was a self-defense when they began.
Yeah.
Zimmerman was sitting at home, and when they went back to him and said, listen, we got to bring you back in, charge you, and charge you. They overcharged him when they charged him. Their strategy inside of court was bad. The selection process for jurors was not the greatest.
They withheld evidence.
Absolutely.
Nothing. That is a cardinal sin. In the law, I could tell you this prosecutor, what's her name? That wackadoodle prosecutor down there in Florida. What a goofball she is.
She was attorney general, isn't she?
Pardon me?
She was attorney general, isn't she?
Yeah. She's state. I. Who is this woman?
You
got to read about this woman, what she did. This woman ought to be disbarred.
But you got to understand, these people are elected to office. They're appointed to office. They're a part of a political structure. And when you are not a part of the political structure, and this is where my fault comes in with African Americans, You want to be reactionary to something that you should have been proactive about when you went to the ballot box, because you support people not based upon who they are, but based upon their political party, not for what they do, but not for what they say, but before whatever, because they have pretty glowing pictures.
I don't know. People don't seem to understand. When you get somebody like that attorney general down there in Florida, who you agree with politically, and you agree with what she does to somebody, that like she pulled with Zimmerman down there. What people don't understand is she's not going to be in that office forever. And one of these days, somebody's going to be there that you don't like, and that person will do to you
what they done.
What they did to what this woman did to Zimmerman. It is horrible. This is a pervasive in our country right now. I'm 63 years old. In my lifetime, I've never seen stuff going on like I see going on right now. My grandparents who came here for freedom are rolling over in their graves.
But Mark, this is the issue. Trayvon, the whole system is messed up, and maybe we should learn a lesson. One, block watches ought to have rules about who they pursue, who they go after, and what they do.
Right.
Just that simple. You have to identify yourself.
Right.
You got it. There's more has to happen here. But I want you guys to listen to this because I haven't heard it, and it's about Black Panthers offering a $10,000 bounty for George Zimmerman, and this is not how you handle it. In any way, shape of the imagination, is it not going to play or what?
We're already getting support from athletes and entertainers as we speak. By next week, we're looking forward to getting $1 million for the capture of George Zimmerman. We're going to force our government to do their job properly, and if they don't, we will. It is a very troubling time in the United States of America. We are in the era of so-called post-racial harmony with all people, but black people are being murdered all over America, and we get the same treatment time and time again. So we're saying to President Obama, you got to do your job on this one, buddy. We don't need a beer. We don't need to laugh and have a good time. Our children are dying. And so, white America, we have given you 400 years to get it right, and you still have failed black people. We're not even citizens in this country. We're still third-class citizens. And so today, as black men, we must stand up in America. We must declare to white America, time is up for you. No longer can you kill black children and get away with it. We no longer going to take the words of no good Bill Lee. We don't care who is the sheriff. The city of Sanford's police department has a track record of abusing their power, killing innocent black men and women, police brutality, and nothing has ever been done about it in this city.
$10,000, is this a bounty? What is it?
Well, as I was talking to you off the air, last time we met, we were in West Virginia with a vicious crime that was done to our young sister, Megan Williams. The Black Lawyers for Justice, just like Thurgood Marshall and the Legal Defense Fund for the NAACP, we study the law. And this man should have, all you have to arrest somebody is probable cause for murder. And if this wasn't a case of probable cause, I don't know what case is. And if it would have been a white done like that if a black youth would have shot and killed a white male, he would have already been arrested. And we all know this. And what would.
So what do y'all think?
When was that?
The second part was when it first happened. The first part is recent.
Where they put the 10 grand up?
They did. This is the second time that they've done this.
I don't
10 grand know. Was first.
Thrown into jail.
Huh?
The 10 grand was first.
The 10 grand was first?
Yeah.
Well, they put it back up again.
There's $1 million. Tell me, how in the world is that legal?
Well,
that's what I'm saying. They ought to go arrest this guy and get him off the streets right off the bat. You put a bounty up, you know, for it to hurt somebody, and that is illegal. You can't do that.
That's vigilante justice, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm absolutely floored. Could you imagine? I want to go there. I just, as a lawyer, I can tell you that the law is set up not for justice but to end disputes. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's one of the first things you learn when you go to law school. You're going to have situations that pop up that fall through the cracks. And although I agree with the verdict that came down in Florida, I think Geraldo Rivera said it best. He said this was a technical legal case. If you take it apart piece by piece, Zimmerman did nothing illegal every step of the way, and therein lies the problem. Now we're looking at it, and we understand things like you said, a few minutes ago, Tracy, that there ought to be some regulations and rules regarding how neighborhood watches work. And I think that's the first thing they need to address. But you look at it, and it's unsettling, because he had no business getting out of that car when the 911 operator said, don't follow him, and he did. But that's not illegal.
It's not illegal, but stalking and harassment is.
We're not sure he's stalking.
But that's the issue. We don't know.
And here's what gets me is that my mind's not functioning right today. The 19-20-year-old lady that testified down there.
I can't think of it. Black girl?
The black girl that testified down there. She made a comment on Pierce Morgan.
Right.
That she told Trayvon that he's probably a gay pervert. And he better get home before whoever was following you gets your little brother. Now, if this is what she told him,
right,
you're dealing with a 17-year-old kid. Now, do you think the kid's going to think rationally and run away and go home? That's like waving a red flag in front of him. He's going to turn around and stand his ground if this is who he thinks is following him. It's like a confluence. It's a foobar beyond all belief.
But see, this is an issue, and it has multi different. And South Carolina, your mic is on, and the number is 347-945-5229. This is my concern, and there are a couple. One, I do not believe that the prosecution did a good job in any way, shape, or form.
That's almost a given.
Okay, so I got that out the way. The issue is legislative.
Yeah.
Where the people who we're looking for legislative validation when you're not participating inside of the process as a collective body.
Yeah.
And then I have this issue with being black in America. And this is something that my white friends need to understand. Because just of how we are indoctrinated as a society, black is never not guilty when accused. It never has been. And when I say that, Trayvon Martin, because we don't know what happened in the altercation, but as African Americans, if the roles were reversed, and I think this is where we get off and we should not, if he had been a black man and he went after this young white 17-year-old and the roles be different, the verdict would not have been the same.
Let's talk about this a little bit. There is no legislative fix, let's start with, for things that just happen.
That's correct. But I'm talking about
the worst law comes when you try to regulate something, that is such an event-specific sort of thing.
Correct.
That, I don't want to hear about the stand your ground laws. I don't want to hear about self-defense laws, because that what you get is somebody breaking into somebody's house and you go pull a gun and you shoot them, they haul you off to jail for murder. And it's already happened. It happens all the time in this country.
Yeah, it does.
And, the law, somebody does something to me, I'm going to defend myself. And if you don't like it, too bad. So I don't want to hear about the stand your ground and self-defense rules, because there's just too many problems with that.
Well, you can't
hold on, Bianchi. Let me make this point. Hold on.
When you look at what happened in this particular case, I understand the black-white issue to a degree, But I would hazard to guess, I don't believe Zimmerman was a racist. I just don't. And I don't believe he went after him because he shot him because he was black.
I agree with you. Don't get me wrong. I agree with you. I do not believe he went at, this was racially motivated by the media, period.
Period.
But
no,
my issue is now, this is where the lack of compassion and the lack of knowledge comes in the conversation. If all things being equal, and Trayvon Martin was a white little man, little boy named Ken, and George Zimmerman was called Trayvon, the verdict would have come back at least guilty for manslaughter.
How could you know that?
Because
black folks.
How can you say the prosecutor didn't do his job when you can't find nothing that what Zimmerman done was wrong?
Trayvon wasn't on trial.
Zimmerman was.
What I said was the burden of proof was on the prosecutor, and what they charged him with for the strategy that they had, they did not do a good job of making the case for the state for the charges that they said that he had actually been a part of.
Here's the thing, Tracy. Man, self-defense, which was the defense here.
Correct.
Self-defense.
It was self-defense.
Self-defense for second-degree murder is also self-defense for manslaughter.
Okay.
And looking at the evidence that was presented, and I think one of the things that struck me about this is when the verdict was read, they showed the judge. And that's the first smile I saw on her face the entire trial. And the smile wasn't because she was faced with a problem. That problem was is that had they found him guilty of manslaughter, the defense would have raised a motion, would have moved to have the verdict set aside because they did not meet the burden of proof, and she would have had to have granted it.
Correct.
Which would have been worse
for her,
for everybody. That verdict would have been overturned, whether it was with her or up at the Court of Appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't prove their case. And it's not because they did a bad job. There was no case. If your attitude with the law is this person got hurt or this person's dead, somebody has to pay, that's not how our legal system works. There has to be legal culpability.
But Bianca, go ahead and jump in, because my problem is – with the profiling of America, with the stalking of black men and young boys and young men, if the young
you
boy
know
was
that...
just walking, no, listen, no, hold on, Bianca. If the young boy was just walking home, and because for him to be up that close and personal, he said he jumped out of nowhere and just jumped him. But,
well, you know this profiling thing, basketball. Scouts go to playgrounds where black children are playing for potential talent. That's profiling too, because they know that the majority of the basketball talent lie within the black population. So why do we know when you come down to crime, and we know the picture of a lot of crime that goes on, especially the type of crime that's dealing with poverty and robbery and something like that, is held among the black population in this country. I mean, that's just true.
What do you do with
they
want to take this case in which everybody starts by saying race didn't have a part in it, and then extrapolate it out to race.
The way it was handled, it was baited by MSNBC and Al Sharpton. That's how it began.
Yeah.
And they turned this in from a violent act into a racial act. But when you watch the trial like you did, and when you see all things being equal, you have to realize in the mindset of most African Americans, we believe in our heart, including me, as conservative as I am, and as many white friends I believe are not racist. Some are ignorant and stupid, but not racist. If it had been a black man sitting in George Zimmerman's case and a little white boy at 17 the verdict because they made Trayvon to be the assailant. They made him to be – George Zimmerman was scared for his life. Well, man, you brought a gunfight to a fist fight. And all you had to do was say, while you were screaming, saying, I'm Block Watch. I am Block Watch. I am Block Watch. You could have said something, young man. You didn't.
You don't know.
You could have. You
don't know.
He
we
could.
Don't know.
What I'm saying is, but you could. Yes, South Carolina.
Now, where the racism come? Where the racist elements come in? Where the racist element comes in. Go ahead, South Carolina.
I've got here. I just pulled up something to kind of get an idea. The property crime rate in Sanford, Florida, is twice the national average. The violent crime rate is 1.5 times the national average. In that area, you got Lake Mary, Midway, Oviedo, Altamont Springs, and Orange City. Orange City has the highest crime rate, but Sanford is the next highest. So that's a lot of property crimes. You're talking about in 2011.
South Carolina?
South Carolina,
I don't care if 100% of the crime rate is everybody's getting robbed. It's just because you see a young man walking around the corners and around the street doesn't mean follow him and say that it's him.
Well, the next logical thing that's going to happen is they're going to want to do away with Block Watch.
But they need to have some parameters of Block Watch. You just should not be block watching without any identification, without anything, and following people. Following people in the middle of the night, I don't care what age you are, is not what you call a comfortable thing, especially if you're following me up close. Because for me to be able to turn around and cold cock you after a while, I had to be up close and personal. And for you never still to tell me that you were block watch is a problem. Hold on just a second. Local call, your mic is on.
Yes, is that me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This stand your ground law was not used in this case whatsoever.
That's correct.
It's been reported over the radio that the stand your ground laws down in Florida has been used by more black people than white people on top of that. Now, if you can locate, you can also find a trial going on in August down in Georgia where a black man walked up to a white girl pushing a baby with a stroller. He was robbing her. He said, give me your money. She says, I don't have any. The black person shot the baby.
I remember that.
An 18-month-old baby. Now, that is sad, and that is sickening.
I agree.
Now, the rest of this stuff, this whole stuff goes both ways. Now, on top of that, we just reported that a cops walked into an apartment building looking for a man that was under a warrant. So they found the man, and they arrested the man, and then they broke into the downstairs basement apartment, opened the door, busted in the door, and shot the man 16 times. Now, whether he's white or black, it doesn't matter. But the man lived, and they're facing a big lawsuit because he wasn't even involved in anything whatsoever. And then we've got the Scott case out in Arizona, where the cops appraised the man's property, a white man, and then went in and shot him. So these cops are out of control. The government's out of control. Obama is sickening, and so is Holder. And
well, he's right about that, too.
Well, tell us what you really think.
Trying to create a riot and make a riot and mix the people all up, so that they can divide and conquer every American in this United States. And everybody got to start waking up to what's going on, because this is sad.
Yeah,
and
what he said there was good, but you contradict yourself in the end.
And I don't want to lose you, if you don't mind. And so have a happy day.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Dover.
You know what, Tracy?
Go ahead.
See, what the gentleman said had a lot of truth, and it also contradicts itself. See, the thing is, with this case with Trayvon Martin is that the parents, not only the parents, but the people there was getting sick and tired of the police not properly investigating incidents like the one we're talking about. That was the initial outcry. 3 days before the parents were even notified that the children was laying, his child was laying in the morgue. Then they just didn't even investigate it to the point whether they said that whether Zimmerman was right or wrong, or guilty or innocent in what he done. That's what the people in the area was fed up with, the lackadaisiness of police investigations and crimes, especially crimes when it's, they don't care if it was black on black. They want it investigated.
And that makes sense. Local call, your mic is on.
Is that me?
Yes.
I called before. I had one more point. When they announced it, was that the same network that announced Gore, and it wasn't Gore? It was Bush, remember? Dan
Mark,
Rather called it early?
I don't remember. I don't want to. I have no. I can't remember that far. That's 2000 and 2000.
I can't remember what I had
yeah.
for breakfast this morning.
I can't remember that.
I just meant the political side of it. You know
yeah.
how fast they were to call it. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
As a bigger view of as, if you want to look at this, if the Zimmerman Martin case is.
Sorry about that.
An overview of ills in society, that's one thing. But to sit around and, you know, say legally this, legally that, there was no case. How else to put it? That's the law. There was no case. And what I'm seeing is just unbelievable. You got to have, you know, these people that were on that jury didn't ask to be there. They were brought there. You got to, if any gun jury duty, get a thing in the mail saying show up or we're going to come get you. The comments that have been made, and I think what disturbs me the most, I know that had the federal government not gotten involved with this and had they not put pressure on the state of Florida to come in and fire the police chief and whatever they had to do to get this thing to trial, had it been able to follow the normal course, I think Zimmerman would have been convicted of something. I'm not sure what.
Something.
He would have been convicted of something.
Even if it was involuntary manslaughter.
So you force a trial on a set of, and you lie about the evidence to the defense attorney. I mean, all that stuff that they did, it's bad, bad stuff. Now, the chances of George Zimmerman, and I said this with O.J. Simpson, I think prosecutors have to take their job responsibly. They can't be politically motivated. They need to do their job and do it honestly and correctly. The chances of O.J. Simpson or George Zimmerman killing me are slim to none. The chances of the prosecutor of the state launching a political prosecution against me, that's a real possibility. My interests are served by the legal system working the way it's supposed to work. That's what protects us. If we destroy it with politics, we're done as a nation.
We're already destroying it. 360.
No, you guys brought it up. The great points to work. Last night on Hannity, you had my man Ben Carson and the former NAACP director, Bond, they told Hannity, they shut Hannity up, which was really surprising because he has this thing that he runs down. Well, he was on top of him, you know, MMA style, punching him out. Well, he called the MMA style. He followed that young man down the street. And so following the man down the street, Ben Carson said, you know what, when I was going up in Detroit, when somebody's following you down the street, it's usually not a good thing, and you have two things on your mind, fight or flight. And he said he tried to run already, and Zimmerman, you know, you got to understand, he did want to protect his neighborhood from the break-ins that had been happening. However, there was a way that he should have gotten out of this. And he said this was not a murder two charge. He said this was murder three or manslaughter. Well, Sean just crumpled down in a heap with that one. And then Bond told him, look, the only thing he had to do, he said, I don't think the man is a racist. I think that the man had bad judgment. And I think that all he had to do was say, I'm Block Watch, which myself have been saying for the past month, that all he had to do was say he was Block Watch, and it would probably would have been over. But at least it would have been totally justified at that time if he had done that without saying anything else. And then if he got punched, well, then the guy deserved to get killed. You know, that's different. But he did not identify himself. He gave him no respect. And this is why people are saying that black men in America do not get respect. I know they don't want to hear that, but we're not respected like everybody else. You know, you're followed immediately in a store if you're dressed a certain way. You're followed. But a white man comes to that store and he's dressed a certain way, he is not going to be followed because they're not going to consider him a criminal. I'm automatically considered bad. I'm automatically considered a criminal. I'm automatically considered guilty, even if I'm innocent. And what this is about, I hate to say that it's a smokescreen for all the other craziness that this administration is doing. It is. And I hate that part of it because they do not deserve cover. And that's why they're going after this one. And that's why, you know, I made the statement that, hey, look at this. Eric Holder, he's all gung-ho going to investigate this, but he didn't want to do Benghazi. He didn't want to do IRS. He didn't want to do Fast and Furious with a dead border guard. So, no, he does not need to get into this. He needs to shut up, go somewhere, and try to straighten out his life before they make him resign anyway. This is crazy.
And let me see, I got to take a break, and when I come back, we'll continue in weighing on this conversation. But I do have to say this. This has been a great smokescreen and changed the course of the conversation because it has taken us off of IRS, Snowden,
yep.
Watching people,
absolutely.
Benghazi.
Absolutely.
It has really been a game changer. The question is, can we change the game back? I'll be right back. You're listening to Tracy and Friends here on WSOM AM 600. Listen, I'm going to leave the mics on there in the chat room. You guys can go ahead on with conversation. We'll see you on the other side.
Everyone faces.
You know, another thing that's deplorable in all this is these crazy attempts to try to amalgamate the entire population of this country. You have pockets of ethnic groups like the Great Amish and the Quakers that enjoy their lives, don't bother nobody, don't cause no trouble. But somebody can look at them and say, something's wrong with that. We need to kind of spot it up a little bit. That's totally foolish.
Well, that's what you have going on because I hate to say it, but the liberals love to merchandise black people. It's their bread and butter. They make so much money off of dividing the races that it's really ridiculous. They make tons of money off of that. How they do it? Well, they get you to go vote. They get you all riled up because this is nothing but midterm stand your ground law. They got black people clapping for wanting to get rid of stand your ground. Oh, you got to be a fool to get rid of stand your ground. Because stand your ground will help you defend yourself against some of these crazy folk out here that don't care for you. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, some of them just got a vendetta for white folks anyway.
Well, I understood it. But the thing is that's what this is all about, man. And, you know, holding them don't want you to have the ability to defend yourself.
I think Holder know better. I think you got these organizations like that fraternity he spoke to yesterday, the Urban League and DNAACP and so on and so on and so on. I think they're the ones that it must be something wrong with them.
Well, there is something wrong with them. The left feeds them every time they pay a couple of big name passes like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton to be their mouthpieces. Because before Al Sharpton got a check, his book and his speeches were all about the black community being self-reliant. Now everything all of a sudden is about, you know, getting of the government doing this, that, or the other. It ain't right. It's just not right.
Like here, they going back to busing children out of these so-called unaccredited school districts. In one school district I've been in for 42, 43 years. And there's no reason. I mean, we built brand new schools, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Last school built was named after Barack Obama. We have brand new athletic facilities, Jeff. We have brand new baseball field, Jeff. We remodeled the high school where it has a grand entrance, brand new windows, brand new roof, two computer labs, infrastructure throughout the district for internet and broadband, and what? They still can't get it together as far as the academic achievement with the children. They want to send the children out 20-minute ride into white enclaves that whites have built for themselves. They have those things set in place. Their children are performing. They are responsible. When things are not going right, they complain and fire the board. Why come black folks can't do the same thing?
Because they were told that the federal government is your savior, and they have to do the same for you. They have to take care of you. That's the white liberal moniker. It is, look, you can't do it by yourself. Let me help you. And then they give you what they want you to have instead of what you really need or what, you know, you could do much better by doing it yourself, even in this racist, inbred racist place. And people are inbred with racism in America because of how it started. And I'm not mad at that. I realize that. You know, you just have to re-educate people, because once people get to know me, they love me. You know what I'm saying? But before they know me, they think, well, I don't know about this Jeff Green guy. You know, here's another thing.
And black folks is so pissed off with the police. Why is it that every black store you go in, police got discount? Here I am. I volunteer my time with Boys and Gloves, Girls Clubs. We take money out of our own pocket to make sure that the children have their membership dues paid up. But when I go to the store, I don't get no discount.
Black people don't hate the police. They just are wary of the police in certain areas, because if you're the store owner in a black area or in a poor area, you are the lifeblood of that area, because that's keeping everybody afloat, you know. But if you're not the store owner, you're looked upon as less of this, that, and the other. I used to see the difference in how people treated me when they found out my father, who my father was. And if somebody, you know, I'd let somebody else mention it, you know, and then they find out, oh, you Attorney Green's son? Oh, man, I know your dad for this long, blah, 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 because he had already broke through that barrier. You understand? But there's a barrier. There's an understanding. There's a cool, I'm cool with you barrier. I don't think you're a criminal barrier that has to be broken in this country. And it's not easy to do. Not easy at all, because they always want to be wary of you. But, hey, Pionk, it's always good to hear you, man.
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, I'll be back here.
Where's Slick at? I missed him the other day. Hell, they marching here in St. Louis about Trayvon March. Got a big rally.
Or 600WSOM.com. Now, here's Tracy.
Hey, we're back. And you're listening to Tracy and Friends here on WSOM AM 600. The number is 347-945-5229. Mark Mangi is sitting in the studio with me, as always, on the third Thursday. Always glad to have him with me.
And you know what? You just, I ate that pecan thing, and now I need to take a nap. My sugar level is just going, wah! I don't see a cot here. There's no place to lay down. What am I supposed to do?
You just have to persevere. You got another hour and 15 minutes. We're all watching the clock. But it was good, wasn't it?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We have good taste. You know, we have good taste in food.
I know. We've had some good eats. Are we allowed to eat in the studio?
Yes and no.
Okay.
You have to ask 360 about the eating in the studio.
Okay.
You know, Tracy, I want to ask your guest a question.
Sure.
I forget his name.
Mark.
Why come within the white population? Why come they don't tell, and you know, in the case you hear me complain about, they've got this thing where they're busting black children back out in the white community again. Why come whites don't tell, ask black folks, why don't you get your house together? Why is whites afraid to let those words come out of their mouth? Blacks have everything they need to change their situation, but wherever whites go, here they come. I mean, of course, the law says you can't put up a sign and say you can't move here. But under these particular circumstances and under many others, blacks could easily take care of those problems themselves. Why do they always run to – whites need to tell them that.
Let me tell you something. One of the things – I don't know what the base answer to that would be, but it seems to me that – the opportunities for white interaction with the African-American community are few and far between. And we as a population don't commingle with each other. We've come from segregated neighborhoods. We've went either legally or de facto segregated schools. And it's tough to get to know folks when there's no way to interact. I think that's part of the problem. I think the other part of the problem is if anyone says it, they'd be branded a racist.
They're afraid.
I would stand next to him and say he's not a racist. I'm sure Tracy would stand next to you and say you're not a racist. I mean, they need to get out of this sphere and say what they need to say. Now, what are you going to do? Just move again?
They're going to keep on moving south because we've moved them from downtown to suburb Boardman to the rural areas of North Lima, and they keep on going south.
Right down south down Market Street.
And they take the grocery stores and everything with them, and we keep on moving them south. And they keep on going. I don't know how far south they're going to make it, but we keep on moving them, and we just keep on going.
It's just an interesting dynamic. I did some work for a couple of members of the African-American community 2 or 3 years ago, and they came into my office and sat down, and we were talking among ourselves about race relations in the United States. And they looked at me, and they said to me, how many friends do you have that are African-American? And you know what? I couldn't say one.
Well, you should ask them, what the difference does it make?
I just met you. I don't know what you do about that. People are afraid to say what they think. How could we have communication when people are afraid to say what they think? How do you know I don't have a misperception? You watch what you say. You're guarded all the time. You can't write anything. You can't say anything. And what they say in private versus what's said out in public are two different things. That's not a good environment to allow what needs to happen to happen.
Does this mean I have to move again?
Yes.
Yeah, you have to move again.
I'm sitting right here with my real estate agent, Mr. Billy Brown, a friend of mine who is black American, okay, because I figured he could tell me where to move next. He'd keep me away from his folks.
But you got to understand.
I've never heard any of this conversation, you know, ever before in public with black folks, white folks, or any color. And I never thought about what you just said. It is pretty darn ridiculous. Just keep moving and moving and moving and moving.
Keep on moving.
It's ridiculous on both sides. There is nothing wrong with an all-white enclave. There's nothing wrong with it.
it's not so much about having
alone.
An all-white Congress.
All black,
it's not about
or all Amish,
it's not about,
like
it's, listen, it's not,
all
it's
black,
not about all-black
all
or all-white.
All Quaker, all Hispanic. There's nothing wrong with that. Leave it alone.
Bianchi, this is not about all black and all white conclave. The issue is we move based upon misperception. People move because they don't like where they are or they're afraid of who's coming in to be there in their neighborhood. And we talked about that yesterday, how people, when black people moved into the neighborhood, we saw white people pack up and move. Because they did not because that I was a bad neighbor, but because they didn't want to be a black person to be in their neighborhood.
Not everywhere. And I'm going to tell you a story. This is a true story. I grew up in an all-white neighborhood right on the border between Youngstown and Boardman on the other side of Lake Newport. For those of you who aren't here.
In the Glen.
No, not in the Glen, on the other side of Lake Newport.
Oh, okay.
For Tracy, if you take Midlothian Boulevard, you know where Midlothian Boulevard dead ends? If you went straight,
yeah.
You go into Lake Newport. There was supposed to be a bridge built there, and it never was. Midlothian Boulevard actually continues across the lake.
Oh, really?
And that's where I grew up, was across the lake. And it was, in my neighborhood, you were Catholic, Greek, or Jewish. And then there's some Irish folks in there. That was the makeup of the neighborhood. Over the years, we had, back when I went away to college and my wife and I got married, we came back here, a black family moved into the neighborhood. And the for sale signs went up. A month later, the for sale signs came down. And it's the first time that I've really seen a truly integrated neighborhood as African Americans moved into the neighborhood. The old family stayed. And it was great, and it's still a mixed neighborhood and outstanding. Everybody gets along and they go to each other's weddings, they look after each other's kids. And the color issue just went away. I've never seen anything like it. And Youngstown is one of the most segregated cities in the United States.
Yeah.
And
it's not as segregated as St. Louis. But the thing is that is good. You got a community that's got white and black people in the same. But if you got a community that's all black, if you got a community on the way far side that's all white, there's nothing wrong with that. No one is telling you you cannot move in that mixed community. No one is saying you cannot move in the all-black community nor the all-white community. People do things for particular reasons. And this reason that they're doing it is constitutional guarantee. If they don't want to live in a white community, or if they don't want to live in a black community, or if they want to live in a mixed community, it's perfectly all right.
But this is the problem, Pianchi, and the number 347-945-5229, this is the problem. We have not learned how to respect other people's culture, nor have we learned how to be not to be sabotaged by where we've moved to. Nobody wants to move and to have a neighbor who has loud parties, loud music, and parks their car in the front yard. No matter what race you are. If you're cussing and screaming and shooting in the middle of the night, people are going to have a problem. If you don't cut your grass and take care of your yard, people are going to have a problem. And what we've done is we've created people move into houses that they can't afford. It takes money to plant flowers and to water grass. It just does. Moving into a neighborhood that you can't afford nothing but the house note is a problem. And we've seen that happen. Have we not?
Well, yes, we've seen it happen, but, as I said before, Tracy, there's nothing wrong with all of one ethnic group, phenotype neighborhoods. And black folks,
it is if you tell me I can't
else,
move in.
And liberals, if you can't, no one is saying that you can't move in. I don't know any place. If you move in and whites move out, I mean, that's what they want to do. Let them do it. Don't ridicule them because they're doing. Maybe they don't want to be around you. Maybe for some whatever reason. Leave them alone. Let them have their reason. Why we want to try to change people? We got too many other things to worry about. If you build something successful, you know whites used to come watch the Negro League baseball team because it was damn good baseball.
Yeah, then they took all the good players and shut it down where you can't have another Negro League ever again in life. And made it a monopoly, federally. The only monopoly that is federally governed by the United States government.
I agree to the extent that I think maybe it's just because I'm from here. I'm used to ethnic groups. Ethnic groups have always hung together in this area. But we've always had health and respect for the other ethnic groups in the area. And that's dying off now as our kids get married and their kids get married and things kind of get mushed together. We need health and respect for different groups. And we got to quit trying to, I don't know. This group's bad about this. This group's good about that. This group's something else about that. This group's something else about the other thing. My God, stop it. Stop it. Whether we like it or not, we're all in this boat together in the United States.
But we got to have respect.
You have to have respect.
And that's what we're losing.
And that respect goes both ways.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. We're losing respect for each other. We can't be what we're not. Human beings are going to be human beings. People are people. You can't control what they think, and they can't control their attitudes, but you can't teach them to respect each other.
I'm going to take a break, and when I come back, because this is a great conversation. South Carolina and Mike, your mics are on. When you look at the school district, and you have a majority African-American school district, and you have teachers who care about the kids but don't understand them, don't show a good favoritism for them and teach them as though they're inferior, I think that causes a problem for us. Because if my teacher is the only white person that I see, and we need to understand that in the inner city now, a lot of that is real. My teacher is the only white person that I actually have interaction with.
Yeah.
That teacher ought to have a relationship with me whereby I respect her for what she represents. Just like when I go into a white community, I have to make sure that they have a respect for me and people that look like me.
And how do you do that?
I don't know that. But you understand where I'm coming
crazy.
From.
Crazy, figure it out. That's part of your job. You've got
to
figure it out.
Well, you know, one way for whites to respect you when you come into their areas is to make sure that the area you are coming from is pristine. It is pristine to the greatest possible extent, that you have good schools, you have businesses, you have low crime, and so on, so on, so on. Then people will respect us from that. I can't understand. We want folks to respect you for something that you're not coming from. That's not possible. No one's going to respect you as being a good ball player and you hitting 0-5-0.
But you understand where I'm coming from. Because when I
understand what you're coming from.
We got teachers who still treat your students as though they can't learn as much.
Then you need to get rid of them.
I guess that union thing, that YEA, NEA thing,
Tracy,
OEA.
That's just an excuse. That's your child. They
Hold
cannot
on.
Have
I ain't,
a school.
No, it ain't my child. Yeah, they
if
can.
There's no school,
because
there's
you,
no place for the teachers to work.
Yeah,
if
they
there's
can.
No teachers,
I,
there's
Yankee,
no union.
Hold up. No, that's not true. Not white, no. You got to go know where I live. Hey, private caller, your mic is on. I only got a few minutes. Private caller? Hello? Listen, I'm going to take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Tracy and Friends here on WSOM AM 600. We'll see you on the other side.
Join Joco Construction, your local home builder, for the grand opening.
Anyone here?
Yeah, I'm here.
There you are. I had, had someone come over. I'm at the office. Had someone, so I had to get off the line for a second.
Yeah, but, you know, you're a white person, American, correct?
Yeah.
Well, you understand the question. Why come whites don't ask blacks why come they can't get their house together? Like I was talking about this school district.
Yeah.
Whites should form a task force committee and come down and investigate this school district. And as I said, they would find new buildings. They would find modern infrastructure. They would find modern sports facilities. They would find rejuvenated high school with new roofs, new windows, air conditioned, computer labs. Then they need to ask, why come you can't get your house together? In some cases, you got better stuff than we have.
And actually, I did try to have that dialogue. First of all, I'm blind, but I was a carpenter by trade. I was an iron worker by trade. Oh, great. Then you understand. In my early days in the trades, no one would hire me except the quote-unquote slumlords. And then, of course, I built a reputation, and I worked my way into getting hooked up with the Neighborhood Housing Service. I was an accepted contractor to bid on things. And a lot of the parts of the town I went into, I had this discussion going, why do you do this? Because most of the damage I was correcting was vandalism in the projects and stuff. And I'm going, why must you do this? What does this have to do with poverty? What does this have to do with discrimination? Why must you destroy where you live? And I've tried to have this conversation years ago, and probably if I could see, I would have seen a lot of dirty looks. But that's a good thing about being blind. You're not intimidated by dirty looks. And I really tried to have a dialogue on this because I'm saying, you know, even savages in the jungle, no, you don't mess outside your own tent. You know, I mean,
yeah, you're right. Or inside.
But it's like I would go in and just, you know, just senseless destruction. I know you're angry. I know you're frustrated, but you don't hurt anybody but yourself when you do this. And then, and I, being a disabled person, do understand a little bit about the one-down position in our society, how people prejudge you and everything, and all that. And but it's like, damn it, man. Don't hand them the stones to throw at you. You know, and so, yeah, I've tried to have this dialogue, and after a while you just really don't get a good answer. So you just say, well, maybe, you know, question can't be answered, you know. But I agree. It's just, I was looking at the news the other night, and I was looking at some of the window breaking and carrying on that was going on over the jury's verdict, and I'm going, you're not hurting Zimmerman when you're 3,000 miles away and you're breaking the windows on some store that you have, you know, some guy who's trying to earn a living in your neighborhood. You're not hurting Zimmerman.
You know, ain't that crazy?
No, exactly. And I understand anger, you know, and I understand frustration. I mean, I've had enough of it myself. And, you know, but it's just like you got to pick and choose your battles. And if you're going to apply energy, apply it to where it's going to do some good. But ripping your own front door off the hinges. And then you got to live in a house that you can't leave because your stuff will be stolen.
And you're putting your children, you're putting these black children on buses, sending them 20-minute rides to white districts. Now, what would they grow up thinking? They think that anything that's all theirs is no good. Look at the mindset that you create.
Yeah. And see, now, when I was a kid, we didn't have busing. And I was from Connecticut. And there were two black high, predominantly black inner city high schools. They were down in New Haven. One was Wilbur Cross, and the other one was Hill House. And they so their basketball teams, their football teams were like killer, you know. And so I grew up with the stereotype belief that black people were superior athletes. Okay, and like we used to dread when we had to play them because we knew we were going to get our butt whooped. But you see, there was a there was a culture in those schools where there was attitude of pride because they were really good sports teams. And sometimes you just need some little victories to hang your identity on.
Oh, absolutely.
If they had been all bust all over the state, they wouldn't have been allowed to play on some teams. They wouldn't have been the great teams they were.
You're absolutely right. And here's another thing. You take those kids and take them out into the white enclave. Mm-hmm. Now the white children have to sit on the bench. That's not fair. Their parents built up that district. Their parents built these athletic facilities so that their children can develop their skills as best as they possibly can. Now you bring in black children who's already dominant in the sport, busting them out into our community. Now, I mean, come on. The white children is going to have to – that's not is less talented is going to have to sit on the bench. Now, what kind of mentality are you telling them?
And in our school, in my high school – which was an inner-city high school. It was 1,505 students. 505 were black American, and the other 1,000 were white kids. The numbers worked out exactly like that. The school was located one or two blocks right out of the predominantly black area of town. Our black athletes were heroes to us because they carried the team. We knew it, you know. And they felt – and we got along. See, that was the other thing. We got along. Did we have trouble? Yeah, there was some minor trouble in the hallway or something, and there was some stupid people who, you know, didn't know how to respect people and would use the wrong kind of words in front of people and stuff. But that, but for the most part, we got along. We socialized. We did everything together because we were all in the poor north end of town. It's just that there was the black end of town and there was the white end of the north end of town that was poor, but we all understood.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I didn't.
If that's where people want to congregate, fine.
Yeah. I have some really fond memories of those days and stuff. And there were cultural differences in the sense of type of music we liked and everything else. You know, the black kids tended to be more into the Motown. Some of the white kids crossed over and liked some of the Motown stuff. We went back and forth. We traded cultures. And we were aware of society's differences because, of course, you know, this is during the 60s. I went to high school 63 to 67, so that was right in the kind of middle of the equal rights movement and everything else, and civil rights movement, rather. And so we were aware of that, but, like, that was 1,000 miles away in our mind. It had nothing to do with what we saw in our hallways at school, you know. I mean, I worked in the cafeteria along with other kids, black and white, because we got our lunch for free every day, and that was 40 cents I didn't have to spend for food. That's how tight things were.
Yeah, you know, I came up and I was in high school from 64 to 68, and I remember 48 cents for lunch.
Yeah.
So,
and
yeah.
Chocolate milk
and,
was,
you know,
was
and the people in the community worked in the lunchroom, and
yep.
the lunch that you ate was produced locally. Now
yep.
it's just the opposite. You got foreigners like French and UK companies that are providing that food from you,
yeah.
and the people in the community are no longer
food.
There.
That's some nasty food, too. I was on the Board of Education, and I went to have lunch with the kids one day and said, I can't believe we feed kids this.
I thought we're supposed to be eating healthy now.
They are eating healthy. That doesn't make it good. Healthy is not
See,
always
now,
good.
Now, if the kids in school wanted to riot over the food, that I'd be understanding about.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
They burned the building down because of lunch. That I would accept. I would even contribute to the new building with a better cafeteria. But,
we got cafeterias, but the problem is they don't use them for cooking. They use them for serving, period.
Yeah, they heat it up and put it out.
That's it. I mean, it's like Swanson dinners on steroids, and it's bad because they don't want any sugar, they don't want any preservatives in it. And so you instead of feeding them healthy and feeding them good and giving people employment, they just manufacture it.
Our stuff was all cooked right there because I know I used to scrub the pots at the end of the day, the great big huge, you know, like 10-gallon kettles that they would boil the spaghetti in and everything else, yeah, make the sauce.
Talk about
and,
good
yeah,
pizza.
That's when food was good, too.
Yeah.
Now you got somebody who specializes in telling you what you need to eat,
and,
like mama don't know best.
And there were two old ladies who were in charge of all the baking. One was named Helen. She was one of the nastiest people I ever met, but she could bake. And the other lady, I forget the other lady's name, Debbie, I think her name was. And the two of them were at it all the time. And our school wasn't big enough so that we could all eat together at one time. We had to divide seniors separate from freshmen and all that. And we had the boys' cafeteria and the girls' cafeteria across the hallway from each other. And one lady ran one and the other lady ran the other. And they tried to get me to play politics. So I played politics. I learned how to, you know,
Why did they separate the race, the sexes out? Because when I went to Catholic school, the boys sat one place, the girls sat another place, and you didn't talk. That nun walked around with the bell and the ruler.
Well, you know, now in a lot of inner city schools, they separated the genders.
Why?
They said that they said in high school, it's
raising
just because today it's just the hormones are just too high.
You're absolutely right.
In my
better.
School, they did such a good job of separating us. We knew that there was no action to be had from any of the girls we knew. We used to pray we could get a date with a girl from a Catholic school.
But nowadays, if you see in the cafeteria, you see the. If you see in the cafeteria, you see the black children sitting over in one side and whites over in the other side, and in the middle you got Arab. Somebody thinks something's wrong with that.
See, I never got to eat lunch because I was always working lunch in the cafeteria, and I used to, you know.
But remember, kids aren't allowed to work anymore.
You can't work anymore. I know.
Kids don't work anymore.
And you can't bring a brown bag lunch to school, neither, in any cases.
Well, you can bring a brown bag. You just can't bring French fries and potato chips in it.
Yeah, it would help if they put gym back in school to get some exercise.
They have gym.
We have gym.
A lot of schools don't. Our
gym was cutting
it out. Can I ask a question? Maybe a dumb question. Are they really cutting gym out of schools?
Yes.
So why is it that
and
you have to take PE? Hold on. Why does it mean when you go to college?
Yes.
You have your core curriculum.
Yes.
Why do you have to pay for PE in college still?
I finessed it. I didn't have to do it because I transferred schools. I went to Youngstown State for 2 years, you had to have PE. And then I went to Ohio State for 2 years, you had to have PE. But after so many hours, if you transferred from Youngstown to Ohio State, you didn't have to take PE anywhere. So I lucked out. But then, you know, they had PE up at Youngstown, you would take golf, archery.
Right.
You know, you're not doing calisthenics.
So why would you make me pay for something that I don't need for my degree? Yet in school, when it's free, you don't want me to have
because
to take it.
You need a well-rounded education. You have to be a well-rounded person.
Okay.
I mean, you just think what a better person you are because you know how to fence.
All righty.
My wife took fencing. You know, the positions with the swords. You know, she.
All righty.
Now when she chases me with the, you know, I have to watch because she knows what she's doing.
I'm learning something
but they,
new
today. They're taking music out of schools, taking physical education out of schools. You know, and you go out to play, my God, you can't do anything. God forbid somebody fall off a swing or get hit with a dodgeball. I mean, it's crazy. Mm. These people are nuts. Got to get the do-gooders out of our life.
What do-gooders?
No good comes from do-gooders.
If you study the history of all great movements in the United States, you will see, in actual fact, by the time Washington, D.C. decides it's politically safe enough to get involved in it, it's already been going on for 35 years in the regular population. I would say World War II was the great catalyst that began to reintegrate the United States, and I think it was just simply because enough people by then in World War II, because of the sheer numbers they called up, enough white folks got to work with black folks in combat and vice versa. And I remember as a kid, I used to like to listen to the old folks tell stories. When I listened to the World War I people talk, what they would say about black folks, and they wouldn't use the word black folks, they use other words, colored, Negro, things like that. And what they would – no, actually, they were more primitive than that. And what they would say is – they would say, yeah, he was – you know, he was – the way they paid compliments, they were almost like stereotypical, like he could tap dance, you know, or whatever. He could sing. When you listen to the guys from World War II talk about it, you'd hear traits that they would admire, like, man, that guy could run. I remember one time we were under fire, and, man, could he run? And another guy said, man, could he shoot? And they referred to him as the colored folks. Or the colored guys, and they didn't use any negative
color
terms.
Color was not a derogatory term.
No,
and it still isn't.
The World War I guys didn't use that word. The World War II guys used that word more often. And again, when they would talk about stories of their military service, and they were talking about black people in those stories, they were in admiration of some of the traits. Where before they were, he could cook, he could sing, he could dance. You know.
But let me ask you this. This is would you believe, and Pianki, maybe you want to weigh in on this. We can find it very, very demeaning to say, you know, she can dance, or she can cook, or she can run, because the question is, when do you say that I was a good soldier?
That was their way. Yes, and Tracy, I agree with you on that. But when you heard the whole story in context, and I am not giving these old timers justice,
but you understand. But
the point
I'm saying
was that they were fighting with somebody who they respected because of their skill, and they didn't.
But
use the
I'm
word
saying
good
to
soldier.
You, the old. But what I'm saying to you, the old timers, even with, because they couldn't say, if in that time they couldn't say anything about it.
Yeah.
But even if they had a problem with you saying it, you know it. It felt as though that they were being diminished in their capacity because the compliment that they got was never about the job in which they did. It was about the recreational side of what they do.
Yeah.
And that causes a racial friction, and it has over the years, and we think that it's gone away.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading something on the other day, and I guess somebody called Harry Belafonte a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And people were outraged because somebody made reference to him as a boy.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you call a black man a boy, especially somebody 80 years old, you're really looking for a confrontation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got to plug a book here by a friend of mine, Sam Beeman, who is a black American, and he's now a Vietnam era, and he wrote a book called Flying Death, okay? He was a helicopter crew chief. And he said, we were talking one day about how things had changed. And he said, in Vietnam now, things had really moved ahead. He said, he said he didn't care how redneck somebody was. When you were under fire and the helicopter came to rescue you, you didn't sit there going and saw a black hand come out to pull you up. You didn't say, no, I'm waiting for the white hand.
But listen to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You are right. But when the story came back and they got back home, what was the story?
I think the Vietnam black veterans did better than the World War II black veterans, for sure, because they weren't told to go to the left line and the right line coming off the ships like they were in World War II.
Yeah, but when it came down to still awarding medals and getting honors, And that's where the disconnect comes from with the government and with everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's fine, well, and good. And I got to put it in there. And people say, why are you? I'm not race baiting. We just need to understand where you see the frustration today that has been built over the years.
Yeah.
And because we will not teach real history in America.
Yeah.
Until we sit inside of, and so, and it's not black history, it's not Latino history, it's not Asian history, it's not Italian history, that's not Jewish history, it's American history and the people that are here, and we tell the truth about
it
from all walks of life.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the point there. That's a problem when you say you tell the truth. Every group is going to look at one event and come up with a different perspective. Blacks are going to have their perspective. Whites are going to have their perspective.
Good family.
Right. We have to realize that. When, just like this instance where these kids are being bussed out into this white district. Now, is white supposed to stop and all of a sudden have Black History Month longer than they normally
Pionki, listen to what I'm saying. I'm not saying take a month out of anything. What I'm saying is when you write their history books, when you're teaching American history, when you're teaching social studies, when you're teaching these things, then teach it the way that it was supposed to be. Don't leave out and just tell what you want people to know. Because
But that's the point, Tracy. Some people look at things different than other people. You know, I'm going to look at the reason why the Black Panther Party was a good party in one eye, where others are going to look at it in a different eye. And we have to realize that.
But when you say Black Panther Party, when
you talk
about
the Black Panther Party and their food program, it was an excellent thing. It was so excellent that public schools adopted it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Head Start.
Head Start.
But others are going to look at it different.
But what I'm saying is history is still history. You can make a judgment based upon the history that I teach you. But tell the truth of it. When you talk about, you know, when you talk about who invented what, there was more than just a light bulb with Thomas Edison, because there was a filter inside and a flint inside. Talk about who discovered it all. When you talk about cell phones, find out who helped build the mechanisms for us to talk on the radio and talk in. We need to tell the truth about all of it. We need to say that when television spectrums were being let go, that African Americans were not allowed to own any type of broadcast medium. Mm-hmm. That's the truth.
Well, that's the truth. But you know, now that Black folks can own, why come Blacks are not building publishing companies to publish books and demand that these books are at least in your own school districts?
You can't.
Well, the guy who did BET,
Bob Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and when you tell he built BET, I think BET destroyed the black community. Me personally, BET and MTV destroyed it. But again, he might have been a pioneer. But we need to also understand that, you know, there are other factions that come into play, and so that we don't make the same mistakes over and over in history, telling the truth, the good and the bad. When you talk about the race riots of the '60s, they were not a good thing.
One of the things that's interesting that I have not heard, and you said it a few minutes ago, and I picked up on it because I thought, you know, I have really not, through all this discussion that's been going on the last 10 days or so, you said, you talked about the frustrations within the African-American community that haven't been voiced and how they got there. And what's interesting is all the stuff with Martin Zimmerman and all of the angst that's coming through that particular incident in the trial, that issue's never been mentioned, not once on television, that this is an expression of frustration and we need to address the source of the frustration. And I think that is a good starting point. We can put this other stuff over here. This isn't really about that. It's about this. This is how it's coming out.
And this is the manifestation of a deeper frustration.
And, yes, and they will not express that, because it, for them to do that, it'll indict them.
You follow?
It will indict those individuals.
Correct, because there's a reason why MSNBC turned this into a racial profile when it should not have been.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's problems with the media across the board.
And Tracy, you and I talk a lot and are involved in a lot of things together. I have said continually that the problem with the United States is the politicians. The problem with the United States is the media, which is turned into I'm not sure what it is anymore. Because you can't fix the other problems unless you have a responsible media. And there's no responsible media right now.
And that is a problem.
And to fix it.
And so when Pianki says, well, how do you start a publishing company? Well, if you don't have the means to publish the book, the means to get it out, the means to do it, then you don't have.
But the chances of doing it now
are
much better than they were 20 years ago. Because
correct.
You can self-publish, you've got social media, you've got YouTube, you can put together something and put it on TV and have 10 million people look at it in 5 weeks.
That's true.
There's a lot more expression.
And blacks have the means to do those things.
What'd you say?
They just don't do it. I mean, you're expecting government, or in this case, with these schools, you're expecting whites to do the things you should be doing yourself. You know, whites are becoming a numerical minority in this country. And I wonder what some of these blacks that depend on whites to do things for them rather than them doing themselves, what's going to happen when that number decreases more?
The
percentage of population for African Americans in the United States has remained relatively constant. It's between 12 and 14%. Am I wrong on that, Tracy?
It is constant for the last 50 years, but not before.
The concept of whites becoming, I'm going to disagree with the premise that whites are becoming a minority. The reason why is that they're counting Hispanics as a separate group, and I don't. Hispanics, it's not a racial group, it's an ethnic group. They're basically Caucasian. The need to have all these classifications of people is a little bit disturbing. You know, whether you're and I think the comment I had, if George Zimmerman was a white Hispanic, Barack Obama is a white black person, because they're looking at they one parent was white, so you're going to have this classification. That's a crock. It's a crock.
Local caller, your mic is on.
Hello. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a lively discussion. Really appreciate it. You know, Dan said something a few minutes ago about there's no responsible media. And, you know, MSNBC, Fox, the two I find probably bland, I'll call it, would be CNN and PBS. I appreciate their perspective. You know, I try to listen to all of them to some degree. And they all have their political bias, but it's purely politics, and whoever's supporting them or that whatever initiative or agenda they want to be promoted, that's the vehicle they use. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. One of the things that came up earlier was, blacks are too sensitive in a lot of areas. If you would take the African-American component out of the George Zimmerman case and just looked at the Stand Your Ground law and how mechanical the law is when it comes to those type of issues. And if African Americans would do that, once it didn't make sense, then you could say, well, heck, it had to be a racial component. What is the other variable? But you can't jump to race first. And whether, you know, Zimmerman is a Hispanic white man or a white Hispanic man, you know, he had a predisposition to profile folks based on the number of break-ins that was in his area. Does that make it legal then to create a confrontation, and then if you're losing that confrontation, because I have the upper hand, shoot somebody? And if they were stuck with that aspect of the law, I think that would probably have cooler heads may have prevailed. Now, the outcome would have been the same because the law is what it is. And did the defense then craft, you know, that Trayvon to look, you know, the first juror that came out, in her testimony, and, you know, she's out there selling books now, and that's another problem we have with our justice system. But, you know, she has a predisposition to sell her books and sell her story. And the rest of the guys came out, the rest of the jurors came out, female, said that, hey, we're not standing behind what she's saying. But the same token, you know, oh, boy. in the same token, there is a predisposition to stereotype people, and if we didn't personify those negative stereotypes, we're intelligent enough to see that and not do that. Not that they're shaping our culture for who we need to be, but why personify the negative stereotype and keep them perpetuated? That's an indigenous problem to the African-American community that needs to be addressed.
I agree. But again, that goes into what we allow and what we allow people to perceive us as, and we need to take ownership of how the media gives our perception and our imaging out, and we don't.
Yeah.
And then we play into the misperception by buying the clothes and allowing our young people, and I'm talking about our teenagers, when they're in uniform, not to go to school in the dress code that has been regulated by the boards of education. Busting a sag, you know, not being clean shaven. You don't have to look. You can have your own identity, but there should be a uniformity that you have when you have something. And our problem is we have taken away all restraint and let everybody just go for what they know, and it's not a good thing.
In my city, when we were growing up, we had a dress code.
Hold on, Mike. What'd you say, local call?
And so I'm going to say, talk about Youngstown specifically. You know, we pretty much control city council and the school board. Yet still, we still have the same issues that pop up every year. For some reason, somebody else is the problem. And we have to get away from that paradigm.
Oh, we got to take ownership of what our problems are. Don't get me wrong. I agree. The problem is we have not taken the responsibility for our community as we should, and that goes back to what I've said over and over again. I am responsible for the community in which I say I'm a part of.
And that I don't know if that could be addressed corporately. You know, individually, people have to say, you know, I have to look myself in the mirror and do the right thing. And I'm not only, you know, it's funny how when you go out and say something, Tracy, you don't only speak for, you speak for every black Republican woman. Well, no, you're speaking for Tracy Wimbush. You know, when I go out and speak, I'm speaking for Glenn, you know, who I am. So everyone has to identify with themselves. This is who I am. This is who I want to be seen to be, and then be that person. I don't know if there's a corporate messenger out there to say, well, you know, hey, listen, guys, I'm going to herd you all as one flock, and this is what we need to do. Now, the message needs to get out there. But everybody has to take responsibility individually, and you know, and it works because over a period of time, people will respect who you are, even though they may not like it. They're going to respect it, and then the next time they see someone that looks like you or acts like you, that thought will rise to the top, not the negativity.
I agree with
you. You know, there's another gentleman that said it's okay if everybody, you know, all the the Arabs want to be together, if all the Irish want to be together, and all the Africans. It is okay, but it's not okay to create rules and regulations to create that design. You know, that's not what America's about.
But it's not okay to create rules and regulations to amalgamate people, neither. That's where the problem comes in. Let people be what they want to be.
Rules. Yeah, that's true. There's no utopian rule, but if I wanted to join a country club and they said, well, you can't come in, Glenn, because this is for whites only.
If it's a private club, they have all the right to do that. But if it's public, they can't do that.
This is the problem. The problem with that, Pianchi, is we will cause that would not be a good way to do it, and I think Mark is.
No, it is not, Tracy. I belong to clubs that's all black, and at the same time, I work with CHIRM that's in public institutions.
Hold on. I want Mark because Mark is. I know Mark's history with this, so you can speak to this. What happens when you have a private club that you can't? When you just begin excluding people.
Well, it's. It's not good for the club. Let's start there. I mean, we have to maintain a certain level of membership, and we have to pay our bills every month, and there's a lot of them. It's very expensive.
What are you doing?
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. I didn't know that yet.
My club has not been involved with racial issues. My club has been involved with sex issues. We were sued by female members. not a good thing. Believe me, it was not a pleasant experience. And when the courts get involved, and when I finally got involved with the matter myself, when we were facing a court order that had been confirmed by the Court of Appeals, which basically said you could not have any more men's golf tournaments. Everything had to be.
Wow.
It was scary, scary stuff. I mean, that would have destroyed, the club would have folded. And this is serious stuff.
There are, and I belong to a group of men in a black group who have developed, of course, they didn't do it in this land, they did it in another land. They have developed real estate, and they limit it to people of African descent to live there. There's organizations here that I know of. I know of one that's in Chicago that's an organization. It's a private organization. They don't allow whites. They don't even allow them to their convention to speak.
Let me finish. I got a question for you. They don't allow white people?
They don't allow them in their membership, no.
So,
in order for that, that happens, Tracy, because it's a determination of whether or not you're a public accommodation. And people of the same sex can congregate with people of the same sex. People with identical interests can congregate with people of identical interests. There comes a point in time where it ceases to be a group of volunteer people who join together. It becomes a public accommodation where people it actually is serving a public purpose. And so, for example, the Rotary clubs couldn't keep women out.
Okay.
And I'm going to toot my horn a little bit that I introduced the first female into a Rotary club in the United States. And
Mary Lou?
Mary Lou. And she was also the first or second female president in the United States. When the Supreme Court decision came down, I made the recommendation within 30 minutes to bring Mary Lou into the Rotary Club, because that ceased to be a men's group. It was a public accommodation. Over at my club, only men were allowed to own stock. We had a men's grill. Only men could vote. And the women couldn't even get a glass of water coming off the golf course, which precipitated the lawsuit. This is a true story. The women couldn't go into the, quote, men's grill. And so they said, well, could you put water out in the hallway so we could get a drink of water? So they put water on a tray with glasses, and they put the tray on the floor, not even on a table. And that's what precipitated the lawsuit. And,
you're lost.
Well, by the time it was resolved, we had internally resolved all the issues. And we still can't get a female on our board because the women won't vote for women. Women now have to send their ballots to the women separately, apart from their husbands. And women, they will not vote. We can't get a female on our board. So, you know, the dynamic on this stuff is always really interesting. And the same goes with black organizations, white organizations. You know, I don't know. I find both of those personally offensive. But, you know, I don't want to go where I'm not wanted.
I don't want to go anywhere that I'm not wanted. But if I look at baseball.
Yeah. But that's a public accommodation.
They didn't want me there, though.
You know, I'm going to tell you something.
Golf, they don't want me on the golf course.
Yeah. You're right. As long as it's not a public accommodation, I don't see anything wrong with people, you know, enacting those ways. They're not bothering me. If they don't want me there, I won't go. Whereas you find – I mean, there's plenty of places where whites – pardon me?
Go ahead.
No, I was getting ready to say if a person, I mean, if a group want to have anonymity, it's perfectly fine. What's wrong with that?
I agree.
Who was that?
There's nothing wrong with it. If people want to gather around publicly or privately, to talk about privately specifically, and they have things that makes them common to one another, and they want to set up a private club. But if an individual had everything in common but this, when you start using race, color, creed, national origin to separate and segregate publicly or privately, it's very, very, very dangerous ground. It could be.
And that's where it falls into scrap. But that
I disagree with that.
Listen, my issue is I don't have a problem with you not wanting me to be there. But I have a problem with you wanting me to be there, but you don't want to give me equal access.
Here's some of the issues that are involved with this. So you go out on, let's take my club, for example. We have rules within our club that you cannot conduct business in the dining room because we would lose our private club status. Because if you use the club as a means to business connections, to do business, it ceases to be a private club and starts to be something else. So
that's what it comes in.
Yeah, if deals are being made on the golf course and you've excluded a group of people to going out there making the deals, that's wrong.
But they do it all the time, Mark. I mean, if we can't,
the meeting is not during the meeting. The meeting is after the meeting.
Oh, I know they do it all the time.
If we're not supposed to, well, it's nothing illegal with it. If we're not supposed to be concerned what two people do in their bedroom, why in the world are we concerned what two people, a group of people do? Matter of fact, we shouldn't be concerned what a group of people do in the bedroom because that's the way it goes nowadays.
But the problem is, if I am trying to get a contract and you can go on
a public contract or a private contract.
It doesn't matter. Hold on. Let me finish. If I'm trying to get a contract and all things being equal and not being discriminated against, whether it be public or private, if you take me to your house, it's one thing. But if you take me to a public place that I can't have access, that's somewhat discriminatory in my being able to participate in the capitalist society that we live in.
I've done construction projects where they would not put out for open bid. It was private. It was a call on the phone.
Hold on, Pionki. Hold up. Would you say local call?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be anywhere where I'm not wanted, but at the same token, if people access to everything that you do, if a club was set up and say you had to make, I think we're going to call it the $1 million club. You had to be a millionaire, you had to be a construction contractor, and you had to own so much real estate. Well, you know, especially if it's private, you don't have to be bid anything. That's controlled. Then you're going to get work here. You're going to get the larger contract. That's just the bottom line. And so I understand what Kianchi's saying. And in a free society, you should be able to be free to do whatever in the heck you want to. But without some sense of regulation, that's going to control.
Hell, American Express done that all the time.
Hold on.
But that doesn't make it right, though. And that doesn't make it for me to encourage paradigm that would encourage that as well.
Other private caller, your mic is on.
Hello? Hi. I just have two quick points to make. My first point is, well, something in response to what, is his name Mark the man with you?
Yes. Yes.
Well, he said something about are considered Caucasian. Well, I just wanted to make the point that they had slaves in Puerto Rico, they had slaves in Mexico and Peru and all the Latin American countries that intermingled with the Spaniards that were the majority or that actually the whatever you want to call them. They all intermarried with the Indians. So they're basically the up of the African-Americans, so-called African-Americans in the United States. you're not Caucasian. There are race divisions. There are Hispanic, are Caucasian, they're white. Obviously, they're white. Then there's Hispanic called mestizos, which is mixed like a mulatto or somebody that's half black, but actually you're not. They're just like a mixture of all the three different races. Whereas you see them with the nappy hair, you'll see some really dark. You'll see the ones that are just obviously, I would consider, a mixture. So it's not really that they're Caucasian. It's just that they have a race. Puerto Rico is not a race. It's a, like you said, ethnicity. And Mexico, that's the same thing. The slaves over there, they have areas where there's just all black people. And Cuba, now there's black people in Cuba. Are they Caucasian? See, I just wanted to set that straight. And then the other thing is that, Steve, are you still there?
Yeah, we're here.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Stevie Wonder refuses to do a concert in Florida until they reprimand the Stand Your Ground law, which is very dangerous law. So now, I guess everybody thinks they can just say stand your ground if you want to shoot somebody.
But
and,
now, hold on. Although, question, see, this is the problem.
Oh, wait a minute.
Stevie Wonder. Listen, Stevie Wonder is doing that. But what the problem is, they're colluding George Zimmerman with a stand your law, but that's not the defense that he used. And we are not listening. He did not use stand your ground. He used right. And the self-defense had nothing to do with stand your ground. And we need to separate that out.
Okay, well, what is it? You could use a stalker law with that because he actually stalked somebody. If he had a gun on him, I don't think he would have been so cocky and so brave. He would have just, he would have
waited
for the police. You know, but he has a gun, and all of a sudden he's Superman.
There was a case here. There was a case here in September where a black woman shot a white man who came up at the head of an accident. He came up to her car, her SUV, beating on the window. Matter of fact, he broke it with his fist, and she shot him. That was stand your ground. So where's the outpour on that? A black woman shot and killed
because
a white man.
Obviously, she was defending herself. But when you go stalking, instigating to pick a fight because you know you have a gun, he's no better than somebody, a gang member out in the street.
Yeah, but is that right or wrong? Or is it legal? It's right and wrong has nothing to do. It's whether it was legal or not.
But again, we need to go. We need to understand. We are colluding. We're colluding different things that are not a part of the Zimmerman, and we're getting it wrong. Yeah. And we need to separate them out. Now you can disagree with stand your ground, not a problem. You can disagree with self defense, but you can't mix self defense and stand your ground all in the same because that's not what happened here.
That's what they did, and that's what they did.
That's what who did?
I just
that's what
like,
who did?
You know, that's what the prosecution kind of mixed everything together.
No, they didn't mix the prosecution didn't mix it together. The media mixed it together, and we ran with it. That's where we go back and talking about the media. The media has taken all these terms and they've colluded them. And they've never separated them and let you know exactly what's going on. So they haven't been factual with any of us. Stand your ground was totally separate. Now, my understanding is if they decide to bring charges against Zimmerman, then he will use stand your ground defense. And we're talking about hate crime legislation because he doesn't want to have to go through another trial with the federal government on hate crime. But because the FBI has already come out and said they couldn't find anything that had to do with the hate crime and or race, that's going to be kind of hard for them to come back and charge him with a federal charge.
Well, yeah, a federal charge. If it's a civil charge and the family loses, the family has to pick up the legal cost.
I'm not talking about civilly. They can go after him, but they can't. But they're trying to go. They're trying to get the federal government and President
federal,
Obama.
There shouldn't be no federal. There is no case there.
But Pianki, I want to make sure for clarification so that we all understand this because we keep on hearing all these terms on the radio and in television and they keep on moving them together as one and they are not the same. Nor does it apply to the Zimmerman case.
We need to get an attorney here then because stand your ground is based on. Self-defense, you feel your life is threatened, to the degree you could use deadly force.
Right, but he did not use that. That's the problem.
Right, he didn't.
He didn't use it at all.
He used self.
He didn't use stand your ground. He used self-defense, which is totally different. And we keep on seeing. So Stevie Wonder says, I'm not going to play in Florida until they overturn it. They think it's about Zimmerman and it has absolutely nothing to do with him.
Right. Stand your ground would be a very difficult one to use because both men had a right to be where they were.
It was self-defense, but it wasn't stand your ground. And we keep on making them the two the same, and they're not. And we need to get an education of separation.
And we also try to...
They asked him whether he knew about standards.
Yes, they brought it in, but he did not use that. He did not use it as his self-defense. He didn't use it.
Attorney would give us a clearer analysis of you know, the differentiate between the two,
Mark,
and
can
why
you,
the prosecution and the defense tried to blend it.
I don't know. Mark, can you help me out with that?
I'm looking up here the definition of stand your ground. It basically has to do with duty to retreat. So is if I
no, you don't have to retreat
this,
no more.
I've never really
Thank
read the
Lord.
Statute. But if somebody breaks into your house, you have no duty to retreat. You can get a gun and shoot them. That's because they were the way the law read prior to them is if somebody broke in your house and you shot them, they'd haul you away for murder. That's a separate hearing, as I understand it happens in Florida. It's not part of the main trial. It's a little bit different than self-defense because it involves, you know, if being able to it has to do with not what you do to defend yourself, but the duty to retreat. And
on the street, Mark.
Me, I don't know.
On the street, Mark. Your castle can follow you into the streets, so you don't have to retreat.
But castle's different than stand your ground. They're all
no,
three
it's not.
Different.
Well, your castle can follow you into the street. So if somebody approaches you on the street, and if you feel that they're going to harm you, even if it's a scratch in Florida. Then you got a right to protect yourself.
Everybody
to kill us, yeah.
Hey, thanks a lot for calling in. But what I'm saying is your castle law, your stand your ground law, and your self-defense, they're all separate. I gotta
well, the courts ruled that your castle don't have to be your house. It can be where you're on the street.
Bianchi, you're right. You're right. But it has nothing to do with your stand your ground.
Right.
And we need to quit taking all these terms and making them all one because they're not. They're all separate.
They both had the right to stand their ground because both of them had a lawful right to be where they were.
And neither one, but they didn't use it. They brought them.
No,
they brought
so
the terms into the case,
back to
but
the
they didn't use it.
And the assault charge. And assault,
and
you didn't even have to lay your hands on someone to assault
Mike,
them. You just had to fear them.
Mike, say goodbye.
Pardon? Oh.
Mike,
okay.
Say goodbye.
Goodbye, Tracy.
Hey, guys, we'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow's open mic. Jeff and I will be sitting in. I've got a friend coming in at 12:05, and she'll be hanging out with us for a little while. But then after that, we'll be into a straight-up open mic. We look forward to seeing you on tomorrow. Mark, as always, it is a pleasure.
This is great today. I enjoyed it. Good conversation.
It was. Yes, it was. And we'll see you guys tomorrow. God bless, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Computer, then you know that a virus on your computer is bad news.